Lake Cree Nation won the right to go to trial. Now they need help to gather the expert evidence, science, and legal arguments needed to succeed. If you'd like to help with this, please contact RavenTrust.com. We hope the show has inspired you to take action in your local community to create a better world. I'm Bill McCarthy, and I want to remind you that everyone can make a difference. Go out and make some positive news.
Japan, could they have really planned it? Headed for the iceberg like the Titanic.
Atlantic mystery, Atlantis right from history. The truth about the pyramids and ancient Mayan prophecy.
Space Odyssey, looked into the anomalies. And you will find suppression of free energy technology. A false democracy born out of a monopoly. Sacred knowledge robbery, like the towers they toppling.
No stopping free.
Jay Bray, no see.
Coming from the enemy.
Free energy. The world's running dry. Our money's burning out.
Solar panels on the roof of the White House.
Hey!
We bringing on some real change. Water catchment system.
We collect the rain.
Time to gather round. The moment's now. I want it all turned out. And from the crowd, be the one who's the man it takes. It's time for free.
Perceive the earth as a conductor of acoustical resonance, and still its presence lives in the heart of visionary invention.
Over 5,000 patents censored.
Researching zero point energy, trying to get through delirium. The unified field theory of Nassim Ehrman, and every day we carry in the burden of our past. Water fuel cars, we no longer need the gas.
So many solutions right here in your face. Raw earth energy, create what rejuvenates. Green walls and green roofs, grow plants on everything. Magnetic movements. Don't need gas for anything. Space mission rockets, doing our own research. Pan out of pocket, bike-powered stages. You pedal in our rocket. Fully access to techie knowledge. Green power over big profit. You can't stop it. Stop.
Ever think what the wars have fought for? Ever dream that the world could be more? I stand my life on one chance. We could do it together. Ever think what the wars have fought for? Ever dream that the world could be more?
Industrial revolution. Invention is the language of a worldwide solution. The body, electromagnetic, plasma, reactive, stubble, field, calcium, frost. Free the knowledge lost. Some people wait for 2012 to watch the earth shift. But in New Mexico, they out there building earth ships. We got the language wrong. I got a new twist. The lifting of the veil, that's the true apocalypse. Show them see free energy as the enemy. But my genetic memory, remembering that that could never be. Thoughts float in the anti-gravity. A cubic foot of space can feel the whole world equal. You can choose a love or hate, we vote or maybe meditate. And every day we demonstrate so we can finally get it straight. Peace worldwide is the anthem that we celebrate. Free energy like the end of the moon.
Time to gather round. The moment's now. I want it all turned out. And from the crowd, be the one who's the man it takes. It's time for free.
Yeah.
Free energy, that's the positive spin. That's done by Unity. Yeah, the Unity folks do that. The Luminaries is a group that are part of the Unity Foundation. San Francisco, California. Welcome back, everybody. The explosion of free energy is just vibrating this planet free. It really is. Let's continue what we started. There's a 10-minute piece from where we were. We were doing Ta Nehisi Coates on segregation, housing, discrimination, and the case for reparations. And this is part two of Thursday's, and then we'll go to Friday's after that. All right, here we go.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we end today's show with the second part of our interview with famed essayist Ta-Nehisi Coates, talking about his explosive new essay, The Case for Reparations. The 16,000-word article is the cover story for the June issue of The Atlantic magazine and is being credited for rekindling a national discussion on reparations for American slavery and for institutional racism.
In the piece, Ta-Nehisi Coates exposes how slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and federally backed housing policy systematically robbed African Americans of their possessions and prevented them from accruing intergenerational wealth. Much of it focuses on predatory lending schemes that bilked potential African American homeowners. Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed Ta-Nehisi Coates on Thursday. For the first part of our conversation, go to democracynow.org. This is part two.
One of the things that you mentioned in that article, that when people speak about racism or white supremacy in this country, they're usually talking about individual acts. Or, for instance, Donald Sterling and the Los Angeles Clippers, his remarks have gotten widespread attention, but they don't want to talk about the institutional manifestations of racism. You write, quote, "It's very hard to accept white supremacy as a structure erected by actual people, as a choice, as an interest, as opposed to a momentary bout of insanity."
Right.
Can you expound
right.
on that?
Well, you know, again, I mean, this goes back to, you know, one of the things I was saying. I mean, we have this, our notion of racism, as you mentioned, is, you know, Donald Sterling, Clive and Bunn. You know, if somebody says something, you know, that seems intemperate, we think of racism as, you know, a matter of the heart. And this is like one of the reasons why it becomes so explosive, say, today, to call somebody quote unquote racist, because, you know, you basically are calling them a child molester or something like that. But the statements of individuals are largely, you know, more symptomatic than they are the source of anything. The thing people have to remember is there's nothing natural about racism as it exists in America. I mean, we know this historically. We can look at 1619 when Africans first came here and how early African slaves intermixed, you know, pretty indiscriminately with indentured white servants. You know, you can look at Bacon's Rebellion where you see black people and poor white people actually allying, you know, in a rebellion. 100 years later, for some reason, that would not happen. And we can see why that would not happen. If you look at the actual laws, what we call black in America today is a matter of laws that were actually passed to enforce slavery. What we call black here today is not what, you know, folks call black in Brazil, is not necessarily what, you know, even what people would call black in Louisiana 100 years ago. Things change. You know, race is the actual manifestation of a done thing, and that has profound, profound consequences. And I think if we can focus on that, if we can understand it as a structural thing, you know, as a matter of actual policies, as opposed to, you know, some intemperate remark somebody made as a result of those policies, I think we would be in a much better place.
One of the people you write about is Ethel Weatherspoon. She has owned her own home in the North Lawndale neighborhood of Chicago for more than half a century. Mm-hmm. In a video accompanying your piece, Ethel Weatherspoon explains how she bought her house on contract.
I moved in this house in 1957. It was mostly a white area. And when they said that the niggers was coming, they didn't say black. They said the niggers was coming. And they just start moving away. mostly everyone that was black, they had been sold a contract. If you missed the payment in 3 months, they could take the property back. No lawyer, no nothing could help you. That was it.
Talk about Ethel Weatherspoon and this, what you talk about is institutional racism, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and what happens in housing.
Yeah, gladly. Everybody asks me about Mr. Ross. I'm so happy to be able to talk about Ms. Weatherspoon. I wanted to include her story because I think, again, when we talk about African-Americans who live in neighborhoods like North Lawndale, there's a kind of traditional narrative out there. You know, these folks have fallen into cultural pathologies. If they would just get married and act right, everything would be okay. Well, Ms. Weatherspoon was married for many, many years, had kids. Her kids are doing well. She's a homeowner. Is a very, very responsible citizen of Chicago. And yet she lives in North Lawndale, a neighborhood that just in terms of, you know, any sort of socioeconomic indicator is on the wrong end in terms of Chicago. You know, one of the most provocative things about her story and, you know, how she came up and just how much work did she put in and the fact that she was able to hold on to her home in that situation is it really puts a lie to the myth that African-Americans who act right, who are respectable, you know, are somehow therefore immune to the plunder that is symptomatic, you know, of white supremacy in this country. It does not matter. There's no, you know, bettering yourself that will get you out of this. There's no sort of immunity for black people who get married or black people who go to church every Sunday or black people who hold jobs. The people who I profile in this article are some of the most hardworking Americans that you'd ever want to meet. And yet they were exploited anyway.
I wanted to ask you, throughout the 1950s and the 1960s, the federal government basically helped to finance the main wealth gathering of most Americans through FHA mortgages, and they built the suburbs, really, of most American cities. Talk about that as a federal policy that and why it basically did not work in terms of African-Americans.
Well, you know, one of the problems that we have, you know, and I think this goes beyond, you know, a discussion of white supremacy and racism, but the myth of rugged individualism in this country, as though people just walked out to the suburbs, planted stakes, and then the suburbs just sort of bloomed from nowhere. The suburbs are federal policy. In the 1930s and the 1940s, we set up the FHA. We set up the Homeowners Loan Corporation. We set up specific bureaus to make, you know, our communities look the way they look. In 1995, I took a trip to Chicago, my first time as an adult, and I was riding down the Dan Ryan Expressway. And at that time, there was the longest row of projects, public housing, I think, in North America along that corridor. And it struck me as a moral disaster. What I did not understand at that time was that this was actually planned, that African-Americans had been cut out of any sort of legitimate housing program during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And instead, what we got was public housing built on a segregated basis, in that particular case, on the south side of Chicago. There's no way to understand housing as it exists today without federal policy. Black people, as was the thing at the time, could not be responsible homeowners. The FHA literally drew up the redlining map and then basically distributed, I'm sorry, the Homeowners Loan Corporation actually did it, and then distributed to banks who used that as policy to determine how they would lend and who they would lend to. The racism in the system was pervasive and total. And the fact that African Americans have been cut out of it is not shocking if you understand what the country was in the 1930s and the 1940s. And this redounds throughout generations. As we know, homes are how people in America build wealth largely. And if you cut black people out of that opportunity, a lot is explained about what the African American community looks like today.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, you write in this remarkable piece, The Case for Reparations, when progressives wish to express their disappointment with Barack Obama, they point to the accomplishments of Franklin Roosevelt. But these progressives rarely note that Roosevelt's New Deal, much like the democracy that produced it, rested on the foundation of Jim Crow. Talk about what you mean. You've been talking about housing, but also Social Security, yes. GI benefits, and how they have failed African Americans.
Well, the sad truth, I mean, like, you know, my politics are pretty obvious. Like any other progressive, any other liberal, you know, for years, I was particularly proud of the Roosevelt era and, you know, would often look back, you know, nostalgically at the GI Bill and Social Security. It's basically the erection of the safety net in America. But when you look at actually, you know, how that was built, Ira Katz Nelson, a professor of Columbia, has, you know, done great work on this in his book, When Affirmative Action Was White, in his newest book, Fear Itself. And what he basically shows is the way that was made possible was an alliance between Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats. And Southern Democrats had no problem with erecting a social safety net as long as it could be one that would benefit whites and would not upset white supremacy or the Southern way of life, as they put it at the time. And Democrats, you know, in the North wanting, you know, a deal, some of them racist, some of them not, you know, were willing to go along with that, regrettably. Social Security, I believe, you know, as it was written at the time, it, you know, you couldn't just outright say, you know, we don't, you know, black people can't get this. But what they did was they excluded domestic workers and agricultural workers. In the South, that was a broad swath of African-Americans. So when Social Security is first passed, it excludes something like 65% of all African-Americans in the country, 80% of all African-Americans in the South. And policy was designed in such a way, or it was filtered down to the state level in the case of the GI Bill, where African Americans in the South, if you were a veteran, would then have to go deal with some you know, Southern Veteran Affairs officer. And you can just imagine about how well you would fare in that case.
I wanted to ask you about the role of the contemporary banks. We now know from a lot of reports that have come out recently that one of the biggest banks in the country, Wells Fargo, had an emerging markets unit that specifically targeted black churches and the black communities for predatory loans. But now as the government is trying to make settlements with a lot of these banks, there doesn't seem to be a targeted compensation to those who were most victimized. Just a general sense that the banks will pay a certain amount of money to escape prosecution.
Right. And, you know, there was the class action suit, which I think does some of that. But my greater concern is that the root problem of this, which is segregation. You know, Wells Fargo had a marketing incentive to do what they did. And the marketing incentive was created by us many years ago and is here, you know, even today. It's not a mistake. You know, they were able to get the memos. And in the memos, you see them describing their customers as mud people, black people as mud people, describing the loans as ghetto loans. The important thing to remember about this is, and this is what was, you know, proven in the research, even after you balance for creditworthiness, even after you balance for income, even after you balance for wealth, African-American was still targeted. It was not, you know, just a matter of them, you know, being poor, being working class or whatever, and therefore being that. It was specifically because they were black. And, if, you know, again, that makes sense if you understand segregation and you have this population of people right here. Basically, our housing policies of the past made the plunder of today efficient. It made it efficient to go to black communities and plunder black communities through these predatory loans. And there's no policy, even today, to break up that segregation, to make it inefficient. There's no new policy to guarantee that 20 years from now this won't happen again. And I think that's, you know, really where the call for reparations really comes in. What are we going to do to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Ta-Nehisi, interestingly, you write that a black family that may make $100,000 typically lives in a neighborhood of white families making $30,000.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, many times, you know, pundits, intellectuals, writers will try to, you know, do things like they'll look at a black family and they'll try to control for income or even, you know, often control for wealth. And there's a great deal of, you know, sociology going on right now that demonstrates what's called the neighborhood effect. And that means that, you know, it doesn't make sense to actually look at an African-American family or a white family in isolation. You know, people are largely reflect the communities that they live in. And again, because of our housing policies, because of our housing policies, increasing income for African Americans, you know, just that isn't enough. You have to be able to then, you know, take that income and invest it somewhere, in a house in this case, and actually, you know, hope to have, you know, some return. African Americans are uniquely trapped in particular neighborhoods in this country. Those neighborhoods tend to be neighborhoods that are higher poverty, you know, when you look at their income and compare it to white income, and therefore suffer all the ills that impoverished neighborhoods suffer. When you see a stat like that, you know, a family making $100,000 is basically living in a neighborhood condition of $30,000. It really clarifies a lot.
And could you talk about how reparations might work in practical terms here in the United States?
Yeah, you know, there you know, many, you know, schemes out there right now. You know, the most obvious one is just mail a check. You know, the African, just figure out, calculate a number, you know, divided by the number of African-Americans, mail a check. That's often joked about. I'm not prepared to dismiss that out of hand. You know, maybe that will be the right thing. Professor Charles Ogletree up at Harvard envisions something a little bit more systemic and, you know, a little bit more widespread, and that is, you know, reinvigoration of the idea of, you know, erecting a stronger social safety net, policies that may not even necessarily just benefit African Americans, but policies that, you know, may disproportionately benefit African Americans, but with a strong social justice, a strong anti-racism rhetoric attached to it. I think, should we ever live in a world where there were reparations, what you would likely see is some sort of mix of the two. You likely would see some sort of targeted policy at African Americans, along with some broader policies also. But I think the rhetorical point of understanding, you know, that this is, you know, part of an ancient debt that we've incurred, I think is really, really important. Just one brief example, if I may. President Obama, you know, when people wanted to criticize the Affordable Care Act, they would often say, this is reparations. And liberals were often caught in this crotch of saying, no, this isn't, you know, for black people, this will benefit everybody. In a just world, we would say, yes, this does disproportionately benefit black people. And that's a very, very good thing, because for most of our history, we've disproportionately injured black people. And our policy should be structured in such a way that take that into account.
You know, interestingly, Ta-Nehisi, in the first part of our conversation, when you explain the part of your piece in the case for reparations about how Germany has given reparations to Israel, it's not only the state of Israel. Germany had to make reparations, billions mm-hmm. of dollars, to right. Holocaust survivors right. individually, wherever they lived. And there were many in the right. United States. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you, you have not always been for reparations. Mm-hmm. What changed your mind? And talk about what surprised you most in doing this massive piece that you did for The Atlantic.
Well, you know, two things changed my mind. The biggest thing is, you know, just understanding more. You know, I mean, and that's the first thing. I guess that covers both things. The first thing is to understand America isn't a country that just had a little bit of slavery. You know, slavery is not, you know, say, ancillary to understanding American history. You actually can't understand American history without understanding slavery. And that really became clarified, you know, for me as I, you know, begin to do my research and begin to do my understanding. And just to, you know, to clarify what I mean by that, in 1860, when we, you know, launch into the deadliest war in our history, 60% of our profits are derived from cotton. Slaves as a whole, and I hate to talk about that way, but slaves as a whole comprise the largest, you know, individual particular asset in all of America at the time of the Civil War. The region with the largest per capita millionaires in the country was the Mississippi Valley. When you talk about, you know, a source of wealth at that level, you know, you're talking about a big, 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 big piece of American history there, and a big, big piece of how, you know, we became America itself. So understanding that slavery was itself not ancillary, but was central to understanding what America was, and then understanding what policies we passed in the 100 years after that reflected that ghost, that continued to injure African Americans, a lot of things became clear to me.
In your judgment, at this stage in the presidency of Barack Obama, our first African-American president, his willingness to tackle some of these issues, the ramifications of which and the theory behind which he clearly understands.
Yes. You know, and that was, you know, it's funny. I published the pitch note when I was first putting this together. And at the time, you know, I was saying, well, maybe Barack Obama should say something about this. I've since changed my mind. I don't think he should say absolutely anything, you know, about, you know, I think the president is in a very unique position as the first African-American president. I think that, you know, shrinks the amount of, you know, things he can and can't say. That does not mean, you know, that one should not be critical. You know, I've definitely been critical. I think some of his rhetoric around culture and the culture of policy is deeply, deeply misguided and is, you know, erroneous and wrong. You know, having said that, you know, it's not my expectation that, you know, President Obama will come out tomorrow in support of reparations. And I don't even think that's the way it should work. My hope, if anything, my hope would be that, A, other writers will take this on and they won't just look at it from a housing perspective. My hope is that they'll look at it from a criminal justice perspective, which is, you know, another way I think this article could be written, from an education perspective, from a healthcare. There are all sorts of ways that you could look at, you know, the dynamic of reparations. And then after that, that we'll have some sort of groundswell. in the country that will build up a movement. Politicians respond to pressure. And I think that's what needs to happen. This is a long, long fight. This is not something that, you know, is supposed to be won next year or even, you know, before Barack Obama leaves office.
Ta-Nehisi Coates will link to the cover story for The Atlantic called The Case for Reparations, as well as part one of our interview with him at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, May 31st, Saturday at 2 o'clock. Hope to see folks there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkman and Feltz, my Tony Rich, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks.
Okay. And again, Nasara Now, it covers everything he said. And people are going to be quite shocked when they see what Obama does about all of this. Seeing is believing, right? Here we go.
Because of deliberate U.S. policies.
Aviva Chomsky, we want to thank you for being with us. A new book, Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal. She is a professor at Salem State College at Salem State University in Massachusetts. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we continue our discussion about reparations in America. Stay with us.
Do you remember the days of slavery?
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 And the Beatles.
Do you remember the days of slavery?
And the work was so hard.
Do you remember the days of slavery?
And the use of.
Do you remember the days of slavery?
The big fat boat,
Slavery Days, Burning Spear. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we end today's show with the second part of our interview with famed essayist Ta-Nehisi Coates, talking about his explosive new essay, The Case for Reparations. The 16,000-word article is the cover story for the June issue of The Atlantic magazine and is being credited for rekindling a national discussion on reparations for American slavery and for institutional racism.
In the piece, Ta-Nehisi Coates exposes how slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and federally backed housing policy systematically robbed African Americans of their possessions and prevented them from accruing intergenerational wealth. Much of it focuses on predatory lending schemes that bilked potential African American homeowners. Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed Ta-Nehisi Coates on Thursday. For the first part of our conversation, go to democracynow.org. This is part two.
One of the things that you mentioned in that article, that when people speak about racism or white supremacy in this country, they're usually talking about individual acts. Or, for instance, Donald Sterling and the Los Angeles Clippers, his remarks have gotten widespread attention, but they don't want to talk about the institutional manifestations of racism. You write, quote, "It's very hard to accept white supremacy as a structure erected by actual people, as a choice, as an interest, as opposed to a momentary bout of insanity."
Right.
Can you
expound
on that?
Well, you know, again, I mean, this goes back to, you know, one of the things I was saying. I mean, we have this, our notion of racism, as you mentioned, is, you know, Donald Sterling, Clive and Bunn, you know, if somebody says something, you know, that seems intemperate. We think of racism as, you know, a matter of the heart. And this is like one of the reasons why it becomes so explosive, say, today, to call somebody a quote unquote racist, because, you know, you basically are calling them a child molester or something like that. But the statements of individuals are largely, you know, more symptomatic than they are the source of anything. The thing people have to remember is, there's nothing natural about racism as it exists in America. I mean, we know this historically. We can look at 1619 when Africans first came here and how early African slaves intermixed, you know, pretty indiscriminately with indentured white servants. You know, you can look at Bacon's Rebellion where you see black people and poor white people actually allying, you know, in a rebellion. 100 years later, for some reason, that would not happen. And we can see why that would not happen. If you look at the actual laws, what we call black in America today is a matter of laws that were actually passed to enforce slavery. What we call black here today is not what, you know, folks call black in Brazil, is not necessarily what, you know, even what people would call black in Louisiana 100 years ago. Things change. You know, race is an actual manifestation of a done thing, and that has profound, profound consequences.
Rama's insisting we just heard this on the post show from Thursday, but I think he's going to go on from there because this is on Friday. Well, are you sure?
Yes.
Okay, then we don't have to play it again. No. I guess they decided to play it on Friday.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess we saw the whole thing, everybody.
Yeah.
All right, then do you want to play something from there? What's your choice, darling? We got to hear the whole thing. Okay. You want to do that? Well, it's about 10 minutes each, and there's seven of them. That's 70 minutes. Yeah, we can do that. Okay, we're going to listen to something by Fred Allen Wolf. It's called Spiritual Dimension of Time Travel, Part 1. Here we go.
Tonight, I want to talk about the spiritual dimension of all this. What does it mean? What does it mean to have a spiritual dimension? So first, let me begin with a kind of quotation. One day, Sakyamuni Buddha was involved with a discussion with his monks. And he said to them, "Verily, there is a realm where there is neither the solid nor the fluid, neither heat nor motion, neither this world or any world, neither sun nor moon or stars. There is, O monks, an unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. If," he says, "if there were not this unborn, this unoriginated, this uncreated, and this unformed, escape from this world of the born, the originated, the created, and the formed would not be possible." Now, what the heck was the Buddha talking about? We read about this stuff, we go, huh? What could that possibly mean? Well, I want to tell you something. Physicists today have discovered what that means. And it's very exciting because it's leading into a whole direction of thought that prior to the discoveries of the turn of the 20th century, the discoveries of quantum physics, and Einsteinian relativity and that kind of stuff, prior to that time, would have been considered fantasy, not even worthy of any serious consideration. Of course, spiritual disciplines talk about such things, maybe, but who really has a gut-level understanding of what the heck that means? My job is to, first of all, find out what that means, and second of all, to try to explain it the best way I know how. What I would call that, if I gave it a title, would be aside from the yoga of time travel, of course, would be the physics of Shiva, the god of time. Now, let me give you a clue about this realm that I'm talking about. Scientifically, medically, physiologically, neurophysiologically, we have looked inside of your body. We've gone into every orifice we can find. orifice. You know what that word means? Okay, if you don't, it's whole. Okay, every orifice in your body. And we've looked and explored and searched and done tests and research, and the conclusion was that in spite of all of the great measuring that we're able to accomplish in this area of the body, there is nothing inside of you, not even a smidgen, not even a slight hint, not a smell, not a taste, not a feeling, nada, nothing inside of you that is called an I. And yet, every one of you, quote unquote, seems to know what the heck you're talking about when you say I. What the heck are you talking about? There's no objective I present. There's nothing in there that we can say, ah, it's right there. It's in the pineal gland. Or if you're a young male teenager, in the penis gland. But whatever, you know, what we had, can't, it's not there. We just can't find it. So what is it? What are we talking about? It has many names. In German, it's ich. In French, it's je. In English, it's I. In Russia, it's ya. In Japanese, one of the translations is watashi. What is that? Spanish, yo. What are we talking about? If we begin to inquire and begin to realize that it's not something that's made of matter, it's not material, there's no I present, then how can we talk about anything having to do that has a reference to that I? I see the star. I hear the voice. I smell the flower. I taste the food. What are we talking about? All of these objective experiences, that is, things which we can relate to the objective world through our five senses, all are clustered around this invisible I-ness, Your Highness, and there ain't nothing there. The emperor not only has no clothes, he has no body either. So what is going on? Well, that's an interesting question, and that is part and parcel of what the yoga of time travel is really all about. It's, if the I, and here I'll throw this out to you, and you can play with it for a moment. If this conceptual I is not real, then it's got to be something which is imaginal, something which we imagine, something we create from the mind in some way. Okay, we can talk about whether the mind is real either, but either. But let's just stay with this for a moment. Let me use some structure, even though I may throw it away later on. If we say that, then it's conceptual, then that means that it's subject to change. I mean, this may be hard to change because it seems to be pretty solid. Later on, we'll find out what that solidity is all about. But right now, I'll take it for granted it's solid. It doesn't seem to be subject to much change. But the I is not even solid. So what can it mean? Is it changeable? Well, if it is changeable, what would happen if we began to cultivate, to instigate, to promulgate, to propagate, to get out there the idea that let's start changing what we mean by our I and see what kind of universe we can create? Is it possible that things could change if we begin to change the I? Not only that, suppose we become aware of how we can use this I, change it, modify it, make it bigger, make it smaller, see where it gets caught in traps, see where it is allowed to get free, see how it changes, and begin to possibly exercise a kind of, I won't use the word control, but let's say a resonance with. What could we learn from that? From my understanding of this, and from the teachings of ancient Indian philosophy, particularly those of Patanjali, who wrote something called the Yoga Sutras.
Yeah.
This is not only a question worth considering, it is the only question worth considering. It is the question. It is the centerpiece of all yogic philosophy. It is the central piece of all spirituality. It is the only thing we really can deal with in our quest for spiritual resonance with God, with spirit, with your wife or your husband or George Bush or John Kerry. I don't care who you're trying to resonate with, but it's only through that that we can find this kind of thing that we're talking about. It also turns out, according to Patanjali and some of the teachings and from some of the work and research work that I've now done, which now includes something we call quantum physics, which I'll tell you more about in a little while, it now appears that it is very intimately connected with time itself. Now, this is something that may sound new, but it actually turns out to be as old as the teachings of Patanjali, which goes back 2,500 years. It goes back 500 years before the birth of Christ.
Okay, next one, Rama.
Okay. Okay.
2 of 7. You got to probably put it up there.
Yeah, I do.
Second, we got to do a little dancing with the computer here.
Yeah.
Kind of have to keep up with that now. Next time you do a little ahead of time, okay?
Yeah. Okay.
Where is it?
Huh. I'm not sure.
Huh.
I hope they didn't take it away.
Oh, that was good.
Yeah.
So where's part 2 of 7? Click on that again up there. Make sure you got to the next one.
Maybe I should go here. I don't know.
There's that one over there at the end was said it.
It did? That's the same one.
Is that the same one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. I don't know.
Okay, well, let's do a different one then. As long as we're on Dr. Fred, how about shamanic physics? Or this one, the quantum?
Space, time, matter. Okay, that's a good one.
That's a good one. Okay, we'll do this one. Sorry, but they pulled the rest.
Just a second.
Commercial. Everybody's having a Mexican fun time. Oh, macaroni and cheese. Okay, here we go.
Hello, Dr. Quantum.
Good morning, bon après-midi, bonne nuit.
It's good to speak to you in French. Are we going to do this in French?
Peut-être, mais je préfère en English.
Okay.
I would prefer to speak in English. My French is not so good.
I understand, and I'm sure a lot of people watching right now are agreeing. Let's do this in English. The topic
that's exactly what happened when I first started to teach in Paris. I was teaching at Alliance Française. I went to Alliance Française, and then afterwards I was teaching my class in quantum physics at the University of Paris Sud on Orsay, Orsayville. And while I was teaching, I was speaking French, and the students came up to me and they said, "Oh, Professor, would you please speak in English? We don't understand your French very well."
Yeah, and the topic
is insulted.
And the topic is already, you know, it's for non. It's complicated yeah. enough. So let's not add another shift okay. to it. I'm really excited to be speaking with you today because, of course, you're a famous quantum physician, and I really enjoyed interviewing Joe Dispenza and Amit Goswami and others that were featured also in What the Bleep, a movie that has been really, I mean, creating such a boom and an explosion of knowledge and of interest for this topic and this subject that is so important to understand. And I know that your latest book that is called Time Loops and Space Twists, you really put an emphasis on explaining what is time, what is space, what is matter. Tell us why those are really important questions and things that you wanted to bring out to the world.
Well, it's sometimes difficult to relate things like the very things we are made of to our everyday dramatic experiences. And that's basically what I'm trying to do. My big question was, how and why is the world the way it is? Why do people behave the way they do? Why is the world constructed the way it's constructed? And to answer those questions, I became very curious about how matter and energy and space and time all are related together. And that led me into what is called quantum physics. So for me, the question was, how do you connect up my everyday experience, my little life or my big life, to the events which are making the universe appear as it is? And the question leads one into naturally thinking about, why is there mind? Not only why is there something rather than nothing, but why is there a Dr. Quantum here to ask, why is there something rather than nothing? So there's two parts to the question. It's not just a question of why there is something rather than nothing, but why is there somebody who can ask that question? Because that both of them are really kind of together. You can't have a question without somebody asking the question. And you can't have the asking of the question without somebody asking the question. So the two go hand in hand. And that's what interested me. How do you bring mind, consciousness, and matter and energy into an understanding which I think once we have, can improve our lives, make us happier individuals. And so that was really why I got into this whole business. And in discovering just how the universe is constructed, I came to the conclusion that it's very clear that it's not just an unintelligent mishmash of random Darwinian, totally chaoticness, but there's an order or a intelligence which must be present in order for this random, chaotic disorderliness to become not random, to become orderly, to become conscious, to become aware, to become alive. And so that's what led me into this whole business.
Yeah. Tell us more about the quantum field theory. What does it say?
Well, in my latest book, The Time Loops and Space Twist, I got into this whole notion of what is called the quantum field theory. And what physicists are discovering right now is so bizarre. It almost sounds like we're talking about science fiction and not really science anymore. What they're discovering now is that there seems to be a field that comes into existence when space and time both come into existence, and that this field is something like a field of mind. It's not a field of matter, but it's a field of mind. And that minefield has to interact or play with the light and space and time that came into existence at the time of the Big Bang. And in so doing, it starts to emerge something we call an orderly universe and a consciousness which begins to perceive it all coming out. So in the book, Space Time, and my book, Time Loops and Space Twist, goes into just how does that come about? What's making, how does the mind and how does that all come in together? And the current research right now is something called the search for the Higgs field. That's going on in your neighboring country of Switzerland at the place called CERN, which is the facility for investigating particle reactions at very high energy. They're looking for this field. They're looking for the particle of this field, which is called the Higgs, H-I-G-G-S field. And so I became interested in how does that all work? And the conclusion I came to, and this is what the book is about, is that everything literally is made of light. But light has two forms, two basic kinds of ways in which it can exist. One is the ordinary way that we see with our eyes, which we see when the sun rises or when we turn on our lamps in our room. That's light we see. But there's another kind of light, which is a kind of funny, twisting, half-turning light, almost like watching a diver that dives and does a half-twist before she or he enters the water. There's another kind of light which is doing half-twisting. And this half-twisting kind of light interacts with this Higgs field, and it zigzags back and forth, back and forth, back and forth in such a way that it effectively seems to slow down. And when it slows down, it appears to have material substance. It appears as electrons and quarks and finally all of the material that makes up the whole universe. It all comes from this relationship of this field of mind and this funny kind of light twisting with the ordinary kind of light emerging from it as a kind of a messenger sending messages back and forth. So the whole thing looks like a kind of like a hologram, a gigantic hologram. And currently now, I mean, there was a show we had called Star Trek, The Next Generation. I'm sure it must have played in France as well. And when one of the funny shows had to do with a computer, they have a thing called the holograph room or the holo room or whatever it's called. And in that room, people could enter and suddenly the room was filled with what seems to be a three-dimensional world in which they can interact. Could be, you know, they could be on the beach or they could be in the forest or climbing a building or whatever they're doing. And this particular character had decided to look at what is called Sherlock Holmesian kind of environment. And the character called Dr. Moriarty suddenly says, hey, I'm conscious. I'm leaving this holo room. I'm not going to stay in this room anymore. And so he walks out. And everybody says, you can't do that because you're just a creation of mind. You can't go out to the physical world because you don't exist. And he walks out into the physical world and they say, oh my God, mind into matter. Well, it turns out that the whole thing was taking place in the holo room. Even the illusion of walking out of the holo room was contained within the holo room. It was a holo room within a holo room within a holo room. And the guy who thinks he's doing all this eventually gets locked up into the little kind of cube, which is the end of the show, and we see one of the characters who's in the real so-called Enterprise vehicle saying, ah, what are we going to do with the guy? Well, as long as we keep the thing on, he thinks he's living in real world, even though he's just a holographic projection. But he doesn't know the difference. And so as I was watching the show and the show starts to go off the air, one of the characters looks and starts to wonder himself about it, and the show ends, and suddenly I'm looking at the show, watching it on a box, and realizing that the whole thing I've just seen has taken place in a box called my television set. And then it makes me wonder, well, what about me? Am I just in some great big other box? And the current thinking right now is that is what's going on, that there are black holes and surfaces of black holes in space in which light gets projected into space and appears to us as real persons, real characters. the whole idea reduces to a thing which is so crazy that people think it's got to be insane, that there is no separation between people. There is no actual difference between you and I. Even though you're in Paris and I'm here in San Francisco, we're really one mind in communication with each other, and we are all projections of that one mind, like holograms. And that's kind of what my book gets into.
Wow.
So, yeah, wow is right.
It's so wow.
Maybe that's too much. Maybe that's too much. But, you know.
No. This is exciting because it questions what is reality then, you know.
It goes into that, yes.
It throws us in a big loop. You're playing with our mind in there.
I'm playing with my own because I'm trying to figure it out too. And I don't, you know. All of this is really kind of speculative, but it's based upon real physics. It's not just craziness based upon craziness. It's not just imaginary stuff. It really is based on what our current thinking is, what physicists are really thinking about, how the universe gets made and gets constructed, and this seems to be what they're thinking about.
What are the implications, the immediate implications for us to realize and to read such a thing and to start to understand that there's a lot more?
Well, I think the main realization is to recognize that yourself is such a thing as this projection. So in a real sense, you're an actor on the stage which you call the world in which you exist, and you are the writer of the scenery, of the scenes you're seeing, and you're also the director who's directing you as the actor in the performance you're presently having. It's kind of like we're playing roles in a four-dimensional movie, in which the film industry is just simply a two-dimensional representation of that. But actually, each of us is not, in a sense, real. We're really the creations of mind, and the mind that's creating us is our own mind. But we only see it as we're the actor, or, I can do this or do that, but I can't control everything in my life. Or, well, we have all these things that we think we can't do. But actually, what we're saying is that you have more power to change and transform yourself than you may have thought you did.
I wanted to ask you, because I think you speak in your book about negative energy and what comes around goes around, and you're explaining this scientifically. Could you tell us more?
We could not understand how the universe was created and how it works if we only had quantum physics. We needed something else. And Albert Einstein in 1905 came up with something called the theory of relativity. And the theory of relativity is actually mind-boggling for many, but it actually sets limits as to how far things can go. For example, it says that the speed of light is a fundamental limit and that nothing material can go faster than the speed of light. When you take that and physics and put them all together, you get certain kinds of limitations. And one of them is something about you can't get something from nothing. If you could make particles which had negative energy, let's say, then it'd be possible to have another particle which has positive energy, and that particle could give up all of its energy to the particle with negative energy so that it would gain energy, but then the first particle would lose energy. And if it could go down to any negative energy at all, it could keep losing energy as it went down. It's like thinking of a ladder. When you're at the top of the ladder, let's say you're at rung number 20, and you walk down, then you come climb down to 19, 18, 17, you come to rung zero. But there's rungs below that, minus one, minus two, minus three, minus four. So if we have an infinite ladder, which is all the way up in energy and all the way down in energy, if you fall off that ladder and there is negative energy rungs, then you could completely fall all the way down and you would be giving off energy because there'd be so much energy that would come from that fall. So, for example, if you were to fall and hit the ground, big splash, if you could fall to infinite negative energy. So one of the things that came out is there can't be such a thing as negative energy, because if there was, then the universe could collapse because everything with positive energy would fall into the negative energy hole and nothing would exist anymore. But Richard Feynman, another physicist, came up with the notion, well, maybe we're being too restrictive. Maybe it's possible to have negative energy if the particles can go backwards in time, which is crazy. I mean, backwards in time, what does that mean? Well, it turns out that if you put a particle and set it backwards in time, with negative energy, it appears to us who are moving forward in time as if it were going the other direction forward in time with positive energy. So negative energy going backwards in time appears as positive energy going forward in time. And when he came up with that idea, it became immediately clear that it was possible to have a particle go forward in time, suddenly disappear, turn around, go backward in time, disappear, and go forward in time again, kind of like the letter N, okay? And when it went backward in time, when it made the letter N, how would we see it? But we have to run our eyes up from the bottom, from the letter N. We would first see we would see a V where the base of the letter N, okay? We'd see a V, and there would be a particle going this way and a particle going that way forward in time. And then those two would come together at the top of the letter N and they would collide and annihilate. And that would be creation and annihilation. So what we would say then is that the particle going backward in time is the same thing as an antiparticle going forward in time. So what we came up with is a notion that there has to be something called antimatter. Not only matter, but antimatter. Not only electrons, but positrons. So this is how the whole idea came about, all from the notion that you can't have negative energy going forward in time, but you can if it goes backward in time. So these are some of these ideas that are written, I think, explained as well as I can in my book.
Yes, and again, what are the consequences in life? What does it mean in our life?
Well, it could have – most of these things, as we discover, can be looked at as metaphors of our own human experiences. I mean, for example, what would it mean to have annihilation and creation? Well, one thing it could mean is the following, that every time you have an idea, there's a creation. There's also – another thought created, which is like the anti-thought. So if I have the thought, oh, I can do this, there's also the thought, oh, no, you can't. So there, every one of us, when we create something, we often create at the same time of our positive creation, what we want to do, the negative that you can't do it. We even in Walt Disney Pictures, there's always there's the two characters on the shoulders. One is the angel, one is the devil. And the devil saying, you can do these things. And they're saying, no, don't do it, don't do it. So the same thing is applicable here. Creation not only implies just creating something from nothing, but it also means that you also create at the same time the negative of it, the thing which says you can't do it. And what you have to do is put your mind on one or the other. If you put your mind on you can't do it, then you can't do it. Mm-hmm. If you put your mind on you can do it, then you can. So I think it has some implication there.
Us are not living our highest potential. Constantly, we're not living to the fullest. We're not living that best possibility. There's infinite possibilities that exist, but we're not choosing this most of the time, at least. There seems to be some kind of coherence between the choice we make, the heart, the mind, all of that, that I'm trying to understand more from you, what kind of decisions you made.
You think there's some obstacle in your way?
On all human beings, yeah.
Do you think that we all are limited, that when we try to do something, something immediately comes in and says you can't do it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think those voices you were describing, there is those voices. And
well, yeah, we understand.
It would be great that if we would all the time choose the best path, you know?
Actually, the problem is that we always do choose what we believe to be the best path.
Yes.
That's what we do. And sometimes the best path for us is don't do that.
Right.
Don't go in that direction. Our survival, we think about how we live and what, should I eat that or not eat that? I don't know. Escargot, je n'ai pas escargot, or, ooh, oui, oui, j'aime beaucoup l'escargot. Well, it depends on how we particularly view eating snails. I happen to like them, but some of the people eat them and they feel sick. The snails don't make them sick, but they have in their mind that it's going to make them sick, so they don't eat them. We have reasons for doing what we do,
yes.
And a lot of it is based upon our past conditioning, what we believe was the right thing to do at the right time. We have people who believe very strongly that people that love people of the same sex are somehow evil and should be cast into hell because they're homosexual. There are people that believe that one race is superior to another race. There are all kinds of craziness in people's minds. And the thing that if I could teach anything to people would be to not take yourself so seriously. One thing, I was once on the Larry King show and he asked me how he could overcome depression. First of all, I never knew he was depressed about anything because he seems like such a bubbling type of personality. And so I was surprised that he asked me this question. So I said to him, well, ask yourself this question. Who is feeling depressed? But don't answer the question. For example, Larry King says, I'm depressed. So he would say to the question answer, who is depressed? He would say, well, I am depressed. I said, no, you can't do that. What you have to do is keep asking yourself the question without giving the answer. The mere fact that you can question such a thing as this feeling disrupts the process of the feeling and opens up the door for another feeling to come in. If you don't keep the question burning in your mind, who is having this experience? Who is feeling this? If you don't keep asking yourself, and you have to practice it, you can't just do it once and say, oh, it's all over now. No, you got to keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. After a while, you begin to identify with the person asking who is having this experience and not with the experience itself. And the depression eases, it goes away. And finally, it may never even occur again. Or if it does, the same process can come in and you will automatically start asking who's having this experience. As long as you don't answer the question, you'll get out of it.
Very interested to hear practically what quantum physics can help us in our daily lives to live our full potential, to live the juiciest life possible. And you're saying one of the things is remain in the questioning. That's one thing.
Yes, because remaining in the question is complementary to answering the question or to saying we have in quantum physics something called the principle of complementarity. And you can't ask a question and have the answer to the question at the same time. In physics, we say you can't observe the momentum of an object and the position of the object at the same time. If you're observing momentum, you're in the flow. If you're observing position, you're no longer in the flow. So you're focusing on a particular thing. That's the answer. Whereas if you're in the flow, I'm in the flow. I'm not answering. I'm not saying what I am. I'm not saying what I'm not. I'm in the flow. As soon as you answer the question, you've pinned it down, and that fixates and fixes you. So quantum physics helps us to understand why that's true.
I love it, because when I interviewed Gay Henricks, I don't know if you know him, but he's kept on telling me, question yourself at the beginning of the day and just say, I wonder how great today is going to be. And he keeps on having all those different questions and keep on opening up. And it does bring fantastic things that we can, it opens up our genius. There's the magic that comes, and we start to become magician.
Yes, that's true.
Do you think there's such a thing of magicians of life? How would you describe a magician?
Well, a magician is somebody who knows that there is no set answer to anything, and that there is no actual total cause and effect relationship between what happens and what happened before, that the past is being created as much as the future. And once you get yourself into that position of creating past, present, and future, rather than just being a victim of the past, then you become a magician.
I love it. I'm really, I had a last little question, because one of your bestseller was Taking the Quantum Leap.
Right.
Do you think there is a leap that humanity should take right now?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, whether there is such a thing as a leap that we need to take right now.
Or a leap that we could take each of us individually?
I would say that we are moving at the right pace. That things are happening at the right pace. People are becoming smarter. People are learning more. People are becoming more aware of their environments and aware that we're now planetarily aware. We're moving at the right pace. We don't have to make sudden, huge changes. We just have to keep heart and keep faith that we're moving in the right direction, and we will continue to move in the right direction. It's really simple. We don't have to start shaking the world to say, to make it understand. We just have to just continue that what we're doing. Become aware of our neighbors. Become aware of the planet. My goal, if I have a goal at all, would be simply this. If you are born, you have certain inalienable rights. One right you have, is the right to have adequate housing, adequate food, adequate water, in other words, an adequate air. You need to have basic human qualities, and with food, air, water, and shelter as basic things that you're entitled to just by being a human being. I think that if we each take that message seriously and realize that as long as large parts of our world are without those things, there are things that we need to think about how we can make those things real for those people that are without it. Because we're all connected together, and as long as people are suffering in this way of not having basic human rights fulfilled, each of us is also suffering because we're all connected. And we can't be fulfilled in our lives, no matter how rich or how much wealth or how much food or love or whatever we have in our lives coming to us, none of us are going to feel fulfilled as long as there's that hunger existing elsewhere. So we're all moving towards that, and we have to become more aware of it. And the planet is another thing, becoming planetarily aware of what's going on in the world. Same thing. As long as we're causing undue suffering to our planet in some way, then we have to be aware that we are feeling the consequences. We may get immediate gain by what we do, but in the long run, we pay the price. We pay. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. We pay the price. So that's what we have to be aware of.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this time, and thank you for this interview. And I look forward to seeing you in Europe, possibly en France.
some pretty interesting people. She's got quite a plethora. She's out of Paris. Interesting. Okay, let's go back to our sister Maya now. I need you to take this little machine for a walk, Rama. I'm going to go back to Amy. And she has quite a, just a very lovely conglomeration here of our sister Maya's life. Here we go.
What did you do?
Oh, that's stuck on some tape. Momentito, everybody, where'd that tape come from? You put tape on the corner of that box for some reason. Okay, here we go.
South African leader Nelson Mandela during his visit to the United States in 1990. Mandela had just been released after 27 years in prison. The release files show the FBI was primarily concerned with Mandela's security amidst a number of threats from right-wing extremists. But the FBI also redacted 169 pages of documents citing national security. The records were obtained by transparency activist Ryan Shapiro, who has sued the U.S. government to release information on its role in Mandela's initial capture in 1962, and on why it took until 2008 for Mandela to be removed from the U.S. terrorist watch list. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Philadelphia. Juan Gonzalez is in New York. Hi, Juan.
Hi, and Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We devote much of today's program to honoring the life and legacy of the writer and activist Maya Angelou. She died Wednesday at her home in North Carolina. She was 86 years old. Her son, Guy Johnson, issued a statement that she, quote, lived a life as a teacher, activist, artist, and human being. She was a warrior for equality, tolerance, and peace. Born Marguerite Ann Johnson in St. Louis, Maya Angelou grew up in Arkansas in the Jim Crow South. At the age of 7 or 8, she was raped by her mother's boyfriend. He was killed shortly thereafter. As a result of the trauma, she remained virtually silent for 5 years, speaking only to her brother. She became a mother at age 17. In the 1950s and 60s, she went on to become an actress, singer, and dancer. After she fell in love with a South African civil rights activist, they moved to Cairo. She later lived in Ghana, where she met Malcolm X, and the two collaborated on developing his Organization of Afro-American Unity. She returned to the U.S. to support the effort, but Malcolm X was assassinated shortly after her return.
That tragedy and the 1968 assassination of her friend, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., devastated Angelou. It was in 1969 she was encouraged by the author James Baldwin, among others, to focus on her writing. Thus was born I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, her first of 7 autobiographies and the phenomenal career for which she's known around the world. Maya Angelou was also an award-winning people's poet. This is Maya Angelou in her own words as she reads one of her most celebrated poems, Still I Rise.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. As if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh, does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there go rising.
Maya Angelou, reading from her poem, Still I Rise. In 1993, she recited her poem, On the Pulse of the Morning, at Bill Clinton's first inauguration. She was the first poet to make an inaugural recitation since Robert Frost did so at John F. Kennedy's inauguration in 1961.
Mr. President and Mrs. Clinton, Mr. Vice President and Mrs. Gore, and Americans everywhere, a rock, a river, a tree, hosts to species long since departed, marked the mastodon, the dinosaur, who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor. Any broad alarm of their hastening doom is lost in the gloom of dust and ages. But today, the rock cries out to us clearly, forcefully. Come, you may stand upon my back and face your distant destiny, but seek no haven in my shadow. I will give you no hiding place down here. You, created only a little lower than the angels, have crouched too long in the bruising darkness, have lain too long face down in ignorance, your mouths spilling words armed for slaughter. The rock cries out to us today, you may stand upon me, but do not hide your face. Across the wall of the world, a river sings a beautiful song. It says, come, rest here by my side, each of you, a bordered country, delicate and strangely made, proud, yet thrusting perpetually under siege. Your armed struggles for profit have left collars of waste upon my shore, currents of debris upon my breast. Yet today, I call you to my riverside, if you will study war no more. Come, clad in peace, and I will sing the songs the Creator gave to me when I and the tree and the rock were one. Before cynicism was a bloody sear across your brow, and when you yet knew, you still knew nothing. The river sang and sings on. There is a true yearning to respond to the singing river and the wise rock. So say the Asian, the Hispanic, the Jew, the African, the Native American, the Sioux, the Catholic, the Muslim, the French, the Greek, the Irish, the rabbi, the priest, the sheik, the gay, the straight, the preacher, the privileged, the homeless, the teacher. They all hear the speaking of the tree. They hear the first and last of every tree speak to humankind today. Come to me here beside the river. Plant yourself beside the river. Each of you, descendant of some past-owned traveler, has been paid for. You who gave me my first name, you Pawnee, Apache, Seneca, you Cherokee Nation, who rested with me, then forced on bloody feet, left me to the employment of other seekers, desperate for gain, starving for gold. You the Turk, the Arab, the Swede, the German, the Eskimo, the Scot, you the Ashanti, the Yoruba, the crew, bought, sold, stolen, arriving on a nightmare, praying for a dream. Here, root yourselves beside me. I am that tree planted by the river, which will not be moved. I, the rock, I, the river, I, the tree, I am yours. Your passages have been paid. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived. But if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take it into the palms of your hands. Mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self. Lift up your hearts. Each new hour holds new chances for new beginnings. Do not be wedded forever to fear, yoked eternally to brutishness. The horizon leans forward, offering you space to place new steps of change. Here, on the pulse of this fine day, you may have the courage to look up and out and upon me, the rock, the river, the tree, your country. No less to Midas than the mendicant, no less to you now than the mastodon then. Here, on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning.
Maya Angelou, reciting the poem she wrote for Bill Clinton's 1993 inauguration on the pulse of the morning. 8 years later, President Barack Obama awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom. When we come back, we'll be joined by Maya Angelou's close friend, Sonia Sanchez, the renowned writer, poet, playwright, and activist.
Fortunes behind the door. The cops grabbed Mo, and as Joe ran out, Brother Mo, he began to shout, "Run, Joe, hey, the man's at the door. Run, Joe, him man, he won't let me go. Run, Joe, run, Joe, as fast as you can. Run, Joe, this police holding me hand." Crystal ball by the fence, so they won't find the evidence. Get somebody to tell a lie, so I'll have me an alibi. Hurry home and get in your bed. Call it up and tie your head. Get somebody to go my bail. Don't want to stay in that rotten jail.
Run, Joe, by Maya Angelou, from her 1957 album, Miss Calypso. By the way, over the years, Democracy Now! Featured Angelou's tributes to Fannie Lou Hamer, Ozzie Davis, Coretta Scott King, Max Roach, and Nelson Mandela. You can go to our website to see all of her selected speeches and eulogies from our archive with full transcripts at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman on the road in Philadelphia with Juan Gonzalez in New York.
Well, we're joined now by Maya Angelou's close friend, Sonia Sanchez, who was Sonia was a renowned writer, poet, playwright, activist, and one of the foremost leaders of the Black Studies and the Black Arts Movement. She's the author of 20 books, including Morning Haiku, Shake Loose My Skin, and Homegirls and Hand Grenades.
Sonia Sanchez joins me here in Philadelphia. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! It's such a pleasure, Sonia, to be with you in person, though sad on this occasion. Maya Angelou's death. Maya Angelou lived 86 years. She died in North Carolina. Talk about how you first met her and share your
reflections about her life and her contributions.
It's good being her sister, Amy, and you're right, it is a very sad occasion, but anytime I can hear and see her perform, you know that she'll live forever. I first met Sister Maya in the 1960s. And that was the period where we were all gathering together to change the world. I saw her on a couple of occasions at affairs where we all read our poetry. I most especially remember her in the play The Blacks, and she came out in her tall 6 feet majesty, and he was just stricken by her beauty and by her grace. And I still have in my memory when Lumumba was killed, Louise Merriweather and Sister Maya climbing, going over the walls there at the UN. They were protesting, and to have seen that, you stood there in
awe. The first president of the Congo.
Yes.
The democratically elected president.
It was an amazing moment to see the resistance that they were doing there in New York City at the UN. But over the years, I got to know her in so many ways on the road when we read together at various occasions, and going to her home there in North Carolina when she was giving her birthday parties. Sister Oprah would give birthday parties for her, and she had everybody you can imagine. I mean, you imagine that person. That person was there at Sister Maya's house in North Carolina for birthday parties. It was, you could call her on the telephone and cry and say, what a terrible mistake I made. You could call her and say, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. And she would listen and say, dear, dear Sonia, you need to come on down here to the house and just rest for a while and sleep. And you need for me to cook you some good food, too.
And Sonia, she lived in a lot of pain. She was raped when she was a child.
Right.
Then, and the rapist was her mother's boyfriend. Yes. He was murdered. And is it true she stopped talking for 5 years to everyone but her brother?
That is what we were told. Yes, right. You know, this is an interesting thing, this idea of people not talking. Audre Lorde also stopped talking at some point in her life. When my grandmother died, the trauma was so great that I began to stutter. I was the child that went, and luckily enough, and I mean this, that stuttering saved me a great deal, because my sister and I, after my grandmother died, were sent to house to house to house. And as I walked into the house, it was announced, oh, here's Pat, she's the beautiful one, my sister, and here comes Sonia. So just give her a book and put her in a corner. So it's amazing. But I think that, you know, when you don't speak, you know, when you're quiet like that, you are filtering out perhaps all the damage that was done to you. You know, all the pain gets filtered out. And finally, when you do speak, you are healed.
Mm-hmm. Sonia, I wanted to ask you, Maya Angelou was already an accomplished singer, dancer, actress, but then she gets involved in the civil rights movement. Could you talk about the relationship between her art and her activism? And she worked with both Martin Luther King and then with Malcolm X later.
Well, there was no separation for us between our art and activism at all. Sister Bernice Reagan, Reagan talks about the blues singer Montgomery, who said, we all come here naked. And even though we all come here naked, one of the things we have to do is that we have to make arrangements for other people. You know, those of us who were artists and activists began to make arrangements for other people beyond ourselves, beyond. So this is what she did. Yes, and she raised so much money for the civil rights movement. People forget that. She and Brother Harry Belafonte raised money because the movement needed money. So yes, she marched and she did all these things that other people did, and she wrote, and she knew Brother Malcolm, she knew Brother Martin, she was in Africa, she knew Nkrumah. This is a woman who simply at some point moved constantly with her art and her activism, and saw no problem with the two of them.
I wanted to turn to Maya Angelou talking about her close friend Coretta Scott King. The two shared a close bond as Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated on Maya Angelou's birthday. They would talk every year on that date, on April 4th. In 2006, Maya Angelou spoke at Coretta Scott King's funeral in Georgia.
On those late nights when Coretta and I would talk, I would make her laugh. And she said that Martin King used to tell her, "You don't laugh enough." And there's a recent book out about sisters in which she spoke about her blood sister. But at the end of her essay, she said, I do have a chosen sister, Maya Angelou, who makes me laugh even when I don't want to. And it's true, I told her some jokes only for no mixed company. Many times on those late afternoon evenings, she would say to me, "Sister, it shouldn't be an either or, should it? Peace and justice should belong to all people everywhere all the time. Isn't that right?" And I said then, and I say now, Coretta Scott King, you're absolutely right. I do believe that peace and justice should belong to every person, everywhere, all the time. And those of us who gather here, principalities, presidents, senators, those of us who run great companies, who know something about being parents, who know something about being preachers and teachers, those of us, we owe something from this minute on, so that this gathering is not just another footnote on the pages of history. We owe something. I pledge to you, my sister, I will never cease. I mean to say, I want to see a better world. I mean to say, I want to see some peace somewhere. I mean to say, I want to see some honesty, some fair play. I want to see kindness and justice. This is what I want to see, and I want to see it through my eyes and through your eyes, Coretta Scott King. I open my mouth to the Lord, and I won't turn back, no. I will go. I shall go. I'll see what the end is going to be. Thank you.
That was Maya Angelou speaking in 2006 at Coretta Scott King's funeral. And this is her speaking in 2011, around the time when she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
What I thought about first, this morning actually, is how wonderful it is to be an American. We have known the best of times and the worst of times. We have actually enslaved people and been enslaved. And we have actually liberated people and been liberated. Amazing. Amazing. If I had my druthers, I'd rather be born black, American, female in the 20th century. And I was. What a luck I have. I'm trying to be a Christian. And trying to be a Christian is like trying to be a Jew or Buddhist or Muslim or Shintoist. I'm always amazed when people walk up to me and say, "I'm a Christian." I think, already? You already got it. I'm working at it, which means that I try to be as kind and fair and generous and respectful and courteous to every human being, seeing myself as him, not as his keeper, as her keeper, but really seeing myself, black, white, Asian, Spanish-speaking, Native American, I try to treat everybody as I want to be treated. And that's no small matter. That's trying to be an American, because we have to say, I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me. The statement is made by Terence in 154 B.C., black man, a slave sold to a senator. He was freed by that senator. This man became the most popular playwright in Rome. Five of his plays in that one statement have come down to us from 154 B.C. I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me. And by the time I leave my students and they leave me, some of they have ingested some part of that, and they can never be the same. Be proud, not haughty, but proud of what you've achieved, and see the future as your career, as your job. This is not a rehearsal. This is your life.
Maya Angelou speaking in 2011, around the time she was awarded the Medal of Freedom by President Bill Clinton. Sonia Sanchez, among the many collaborations that you had with your friend Maya Angelou over many years was on a peace mural in Philadelphia. Could you talk about that?
Oh, yes. I became the poet laureate here in Philadelphia. And one of the things that I wanted to do was, the first thing was to have a peace mural. So I called Sister Maya and Sister Toni Morrison and Sister Alice Walker, and I said, you know, I want you to send me three lines about peace. And they did immediately. I got in contact with Brother Common, and we also put some three lines from Brother Martin and Sister Bernice Regan. It is a beautiful mural. We ended up doing a book also called Peace is the Haku Song. And Sister Maya said to me, oh, Sonia, good, do that. We need peace. And one of the things we wanted to do was to have her words there. And I chose words from her book, Amazing Peace, a Christmas poem that she had put out. So if you're ever in Philadelphia, come to Broad and Christen Street, and you see this beautiful mural with the words of these women and these men simply talking about peace, because peace is in indeed a right for all of us on this earth. And our dear Sister Maya was a peace warrior. She was a cultural worker. She was a woman who insisted the way Max Roach and Abby Lincoln insisted about peace. Freedom now, peace now, we insist.
You know, her radical nature, Maya Angelou, is now as she's being remembered. Of course, she read the poem at the presidential inauguration. Mm-hmm. But as you said, climbing over the wall for exactly. Lumumba, the assassinated president of Congo, befriending Fidel Castro in Cuba, mm-hmm. Meeting Malcolm X exactly. in Africa, coming back with him to mm-hmm. help him organize the Organization mm-hmm. of African Unity, we are not hearing as much about.
Right. Well, because that's what you do as an activist. She always said simply, we have to listen to everyone's story. We have to be involved with everyone. We cannot separate ourselves. So she spoke at the Million Man March, if you remember that march. She was there with a poem. She was always every place. Any place there was any action, we used to say, you would find Sister Maya there, constantly talking, constantly entreating people to find a way to resolve and solve problems.
Her books, some have been banned from libraries as she unflinchingly described her life and the experience of people, African Americans and others. I remember when I was in high school, our library invited Maya Angelou to speak. And hundreds of people came out, a rainbow of people.
Right.
She didn't just speak. She mm-hmm. spoke.
Mm-hmm.
She sang.
That's right.
She danced.
That's right.
And she moved everyone together.
Right. Because my dear sister, when she got on stage, you know, she would start off with, and we do it ourselves too. I mean, I started one of the programs, woke up this morning with my eyes on Maya. Woke up this morning with my eyes on Maya. Woke up this morning with my eyes on Maya. Gonna resist, gonna love, gonna resist, is just like her. I mean, we learn how to mix the song and the poem and the poetry and the love. People came in rain to see her. When I brought her to Temple University, there were 3,000 people standing up, waiting to hear her. There were children, little children, lined up who recited her poetry. This was a great woman. When I was told yesterday that she had made transition, I sat up in my bed, you know, and I said, Nanga Def, Sister Maya, Nyinga Deaf Sister Maya, it was important to say, how are you, dear sister? And I heard a voice that Manga Firek, I am well. And we are well because this great woman walked on this earth, my dear sister.
Well, we're going to end again with Maya Angelou's own words. In 2005, she spoke at Riverside Church in Harlem during the funeral of Ozzie Davis, the famous actor, director, activist. He and his wife, Ruby Dee, were renowned civil rights activists. In her address, Maya Angelou reads from her poem, When Great Trees Fall.
When great trees fall, rocks on distant hills shudder. Lions hunker down in tall grasses, and even elephants lumber after safety. When great trees fall in forest, small things recoil into silence, their senses eroded beyond fear. When great souls die, the air around us becomes sterile, light, rare. We breathe briefly. Our eyes briefly see with a hurtful clarity. Our memories suddenly sharpen, examines, gnaws on kind words unsaid, on promised walks not taken. Great souls die, and our reality bound to them takes leave of us. Our souls, dependent upon them, upon their nature, upon their nurture, now shrink, wizened. Our minds, formed and informed by their radiance, seems to fall away. We are not so much maddened as reduced to the unutterable silence of dark, cold caves. And then our memory comes to us again in the form of a spirit, and it is the spirit of our beloved. It appears draped in the wisdom of Du Bois, furnished in the humor and the grace of Paul Laurence Dunbar. We hear the insight of Frederick Douglass and the boldness of Martha Garvey. We see our beloved standing before us as a light, as a beacon, indeed as a way. We are not so much reduced. Suddenly the peace blooms around us. It is strange. It blooms slowly, always irregularly. Space is filled with a kind of soothing electric vibration. We see the spirit, and we know our senses changed, resolved, never to be the same. They whisper to us from the spirit, remember, he existed. He existed. He belonged to us. He exists in us. We can be and be more, every day more, larger, finer, kinder, truer, more honest, more courageous, and more loving, because Ossie Davis existed and belonged to all of us.
That was Maya Angelou in 2005, speaking at Riverside Church, remembering the famous actor and activist Ozzie Davis, who was survived by his wife, Ruby Dee, also a well-known activist and actor. As we remember Maya Angelou today, she died yesterday at her home in North Carolina at the age of 86. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about the case for reparations. Stay with us.
Oh, we're touched and we're driven on a restless sea of time. Well, week marked the start of the annual Bilderberg Conference, a meeting of some of the world's most powerful minds. This year it's happening in Copenhagen, Denmark, and once again, there is very little press coverage about the highly secretive event. But considering the uber-elite characters attending this year's conference, something tells me they're not just discussing their golf swings and yacht racing. So here to shed some light on the absurd underground spectacles, well, some other recent craziness in the world, I'm joined now by comedian and host of RT's newest show, Redacted Tonight, Lee Camp. What's up,
Thanks,
man?
Thanks for having me, Abby.
So let's start off by talking about some of the most notable characters, high-profile people attending this year's conference. Former NSA director Keith Alexander, Henry Kissinger, CEO of Dutch Royal Shell, the editor-in-chief of The Economist, of course, neocon warmonger Richard Perle, David Petraeus, Google's Eric Schmidt, and the Queen of Spain. Lee, what's the point? I mean, at what point behind the closed doors do you think the shape-shifting begins?
I'd say the moment the door closes, yeah. They immediately turn into lizard form. No, I mean, honestly, I've never seen that much evil in one room since Ayn Rand used to have her all-night ragers with Henry Kissinger running the, you know, sound booth and Margaret Thatcher running the beer bonks. I mean, I haven't seen that much. But I also think people sometimes put too much weight on these secret meetings because they're like, oh, my God, they got together. That maybe made sense back before, like, telephones and things. But now these people can coordinate their plans, their, you know, global plans. In many ways, there's Skype, there's Google Hangouts, you know, there's ChristianMingle.com. They have ways to communicate, all right?
White Hunter conference call, yeah.
They don't need to get together in a secret room unless they're, you know, drinking baby's blood or something. But
And that's what they're doing. I'm just kidding. I think that's the real point. No, I mean, seriously, if all these cast of characters are really coming out there, and I don't trust anything where Henry Kissinger is there. I just think he's the most evil, most corrupt human being on the planet.
I mean, what's going on there and what goes on Skype and Google Hangout between these people and on their BlackBerry phones or whatever because they never converted to future technology. But what's going on is there's a difference between you and me and average people and these people. Evil people have plans. They're planning. Evil people have plans. You and I don't have plans or missions or agendas, right? Everybody else just hangs out and we think, hey, let's just treat each other right and maybe play some frisbee golf, right? But these people have dry erase boards and they're figuring out how evil's working and whether it needs a course correction. You know, your plan today was to put on a great show. Meanwhile, Halliburton's plan was to cause a military coup in a country you and I have never heard of. But they've heard of it because they have plans and they have maps, all right? And the good people in this world are never going to make any progress unless we get some...
We need plans!
Office supplies!
We need to get together more.
Office supplies!
Let's put all the good people together in Denmark next year to try to combat these nefarious plans. And I know what these people are not going to be talking about, which is how to save Fukushima, which is what they should all be focusing on right now. Of course, the latest is insane. I feel like it's the Fortress of Solitude. I mean, they're planning on putting a giant underground ice wall to stop the radioactive spill of the water, Lee. I mean, is this really the best we got here? How bad is this?
This is incredibly scary, but really cool. All right. An ice wall. That's amazing. I think, and here's the thing, is just as you mentioned the BP spill earlier, our media doesn't cover things more than a week, all right, except for you, until something crazy happens. Right. So maybe this ice wall will be the cool thing that they're like, all right, now we can talk about it. Now we can talk about the radiation that's leaking around the world. Finally.
Around the wall. Let's talk about the ice wall. Let's not talk about anything else. And of course, speaking of bad ideas with nuclear leaks, Los Alamos, this is so insane, a 55-gallon drum of radioactive waste burst recently due to, quote, the wrong kitty litter. I guess the biggest question here is, why the hell are we using kitty litter to stop radioactive leaks in the first place?
Because at the end of the day, we are monkeys with nuclear weapons, all right? That's what this tells us. We are chimpanzees with atom bombs. That is it. And this just proves the continued takeover of the world by cats, all right? It's because they already have the media. Let's be honest. What are people watching? Can I has media? Yes, you can.
Can I has kitty litter? All right, your new show, Redacted Night, you're going to be covering these issues much, much more. Lee, give us a sense of what we can see on the show and why it's not being done already in the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, it's not being done because everybody else has advertiser influence. You know, we get to go after, in a comedic way, all these advertisers. We can go after the Nikes and the McDonald's and everything and really dive in to issues and corporations that impact our world in incredible ways. And there needs to be a comedy show that tackles that stuff.
And what can we see on it? What are we going to... You got some cool characters joining you that no one's seen on TV before.
Amazing cast of characters, yeah. We got a comedian, John F. O'Donnell. We got RT reporter Sam Sachs. We got Philip Chang. We got a great cast, and we're going to be doing amazing stuff.
Yeah, and really, I mean, this is so desperately needed, Lee, because even, you know, on Comedy Central and stuff, no one tackles those issues. It's mm-hmm. not just, like, it's not funny to them, even though it is hilarious, and you provide it in a really funny way, and that's why this show is going to be so awesome. It's going to be different than what anyone else has seen. Redacted tonight. Check it out, everyone. Premieres tonight. Lee Camp, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Abby.
Forever. We're stronger together if we stand up for women's rights. Yeah, so when I walk around the building and in the building, I'm constantly reminded of Dr. Tiller. I think about him a lot. This is Dr. Tiller when he was in the Navy. Those are nice photos of him. After Dr. Tiller was murdered in May of 2009, his clinic was closed until we reopened it a year ago. We're happy to meet our one-year mark. So. Part of our mission is to make sure that people understand that if you live in this part of the country, you know, women need abortions here, just like women need abortions wherever, and that we want to be open and accessible to people, which is a little scary because I'm sure you saw the protesters out at our gate, you know, and they try to harass us and intimidate us, and, you know, they would like to see us fail.
Mom, Dad, have mercy on your baby.
They track our movements, Mom, Dad, our vendors, our patients.
In the name of Jesus.
Some of the anti-choice protesters have come to my house. They had a sign that they had right here, and it said, "Where's your church?" My former boss, Dr. George Tiller, was murdered in his church. The interpretation is not good. It's, we're coming to kill you.
She receives death threats. Her boss was murdered for doing this work. Still, Julie Burkhart shows up to do her job. She does not believe women should have to drive 200 miles to access termination services. She is willing to risk her life to ensure women have access. But even as she confronts enormous risk to do her work, lawmakers across the country are working overtime to make it increasingly difficult to have an abortion, especially in the South. Wednesday, Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon signed a bill requiring clinic physicians to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. And Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal has tweeted his intent to sign a law requiring admitting privileges after it passed the state legislature last week. That makes six states, and likely a seventh, with an admitting privileges law in effect. Laws are making it extremely difficult for clinics to stay open. Now, if, like me, you are not a medical doctor or a hospital administrator, these laws, these admitting privileges, may sound basically innocuous, but it's not as simple as the name suggests. Some hospitals only allow doctors who live in-state to get privileges. And due to concerns about their safety, some doctors who provide termination services at clinics make the decision not to live in the same area as the clinics. Instead, they live in a different state. They fly in and out for work. Some hospitals require doctors to admit a certain number of patients to the hospital each year in order to get privileges. But abortion is a safe medical procedure. So safe that less than 0.3% of patients experience complications that require hospitalization. On Thursday, a doctor testified against an admitting privileges law passed last summer in Wisconsin, telling the judge that he had been trying to get admitting privileges for months, but could not because he hasn't had to admit a patient to the hospital in a decade. If those doctors can no longer provide abortions, what choice is left for women? In the South, it's an increasingly marginal one. See this group of states? Admitting privileges have now been passed into law in four of these states: Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Alabama. And as we mentioned earlier, Louisiana is expected to follow soon. Although they have been blocked by the court pending appeal in two, Mississippi and Alabama, if the law survive, those challenges, the number of clinics in this region could drop from an estimated 38 to 11. 11 clinics for more than 18 million women. Today, we remember the murder of Dr. George Tiller. The rage of his assassin, enough to kill, is not representative of the broader anti-choice movement. But the level of terror that he experienced as a daily reality while defending women's health and rights, while doing legal and constitutionally protected work, and risking his life in the process, That is something physicians contend that they deal with when they try to provide termination services even today. It means that the pool of those physicians is smaller, and the state legislature is pushing policy that will reduce the number of clinics. Those physicians become an even more visible target. Joining me now is Kelly Baden, Policy and Advocacy Advisor for the Center for Reproductive Rights. And from Los Angeles, MSNBC national reporter Irene Carmone, who was recently in Wichita, Kansas, to report the documentary we showed a portion of earlier. Nice to have you both here.
Good morning.
Hey, Melissa.
So, Irene, let me start with you. Talk to me a bit about your experiences in Wichita. I felt a certain kind of nervousness even showing the portion of the documentary, showing the home. Talk to me about how folks there are experiencing the kind of post-Tiller era.
Well, you know, as Julie Burkhart says, women need abortions in Wichita and the area just like they need them anywhere else. You know, these policymakers who are seeking to stand in the way of women have not done anything to change the fact that people want to end their pregnancies, that they have need in their lives, that they cannot add to their family at this point. So I think that there's a tremendous sense of responsibility among the folks in Wichita. You know, it's easy enough to live in New York and California and to talk about a woman's right to choose, but every day that these folks go to work, they're putting themselves in the line of fire. They're unable to live what we would consider normal lives. And the doctor who flies in from Chicago, who we also interviewed on MSNBC.com, Dr. Chastine, has found that even these protesters even came and found her in her life in Chicago. She lost her job. She lost relationships close to her. So this is an enormous sacrifice that the folks who are in the abortion provision industry are doing. And for it, they're painted as villains. They're painted as taking advantage of women. But every day that they go to work, they make what we consider these vital rights possible.
Irene, hold for me for just one second. I want to come out to you, Kelly, because it does seem to me that part of how that becomes possible, this kind of targeting of these physicians, is because abortion is operating in this kind of segregated medical space. I mean, the fact is, I don't know when somebody is going into the local university hospital near me, whether they're going for an abortion or for a colonoscopy or for anything else. Is there some way that we could imagine the provision of this legal, constitutionally protected medical procedure that doesn't expose the physicians to this kind of shaming and danger?
Right. I mean, abortion is just one part of a comprehensive reproductive health care experience in a woman's life, right? It's incredibly common. One in three women in her reproductive age will have an abortion. And it's an experience that is part of a woman's whole reproductive health care and family planning throughout her life. So for women who experience abortion, it's not some standalone health care procedure. It's part of their everyday health care procedure within the context of their life. So this idea that abortion is somehow separate and needs to be treated differently and subject to different rules and regulations and policies is just not, it's not accurate with what abortion actually is.
Yeah, so actually, let me go to exactly that, Irene, because part of this, I mean, you know, there's been this shift that we've seen in the kind of anti-abortion activity and policy, and this sort of targeting not so much the women anymore, although there's some of that, but targeting now the physicians and specifically the spaces, the clinics. Talk to me about admitting privileges, because I was just appalled to learn that if you perform colonoscopies, you know, that there's a much higher rate of death from colonoscopies than from abortion. And yet, if you perform colonoscopies in these kinds of ambulatory centers, you don't have to have admitting privileges.
Right. Well, this is law and politics interfering with medicine. It's certainly not medically indicated that you need to have admitting privileges at a hospital. If, God forbid, there's an emergency, you can be admitted to the hospital like anyone else in the rare occasions that that happens. But because abortion opponents
Before you go on, I just want you to say that again, because I don't want that to be missed, that if you are walking down the street and you have a heart attack, you can be admitted to a hospital. And if you are having a medical procedure like an abortion, you can be admitted to a hospital. Your doctor not having admitting privileges, it has nothing to do with that.
Your doctor probably shouldn't leave the clinic where the doctor's performing care. Emergency physicians are trained to deal with these sorts of complications. They may be similar from the complications of a miscarriage. If you ask any mainstream medical provider, they will say that this is a matter of politics. And the reason it's a matter of law is because we still have a constitutional right to abortion in this country. Policymakers are unable to say their real intentions, which is blocking women who desire to end their pregnancies. So they have to say that this is about women's health. But everybody knows what this is really about. They have not been able to end the need for abortion. They have not been able to change women's minds. They know that if they go after the women, then they look like they're crushing women's rights. So instead, what they're choosing to do is to say that the doctors are substandard providers, despite the fact that there's no evidence that that's the case.
Kelly, so when everyone says that this is about politics, it really is. We just sort of taking a look at state regulations. The 27 states have policies regulating abortion. 25 states require facilities to meet standards for ambulatory surgical centers. 25 requiring providers to have an affiliation with a local hospital. And the 13 states actually specify the size of the room, the corridor width. 12 states requiring facilities to set a distance from the hospital. I mean, what are we talking about here?
We're talking about a very clear, calculated, coordinated strategy in which policymakers did everything they can to try to enact policies to get women to change their minds and not choose abortion, right? Waiting periods, ultrasound requirements, all of those things were aimed at trying to stop women from choosing abortion. And when that didn't work, and women still chose abortion because women need abortion care, they've now switched to this other strategy, which is making it so difficult to provide in the state that clinics are forced to close their doors. And as Erin said, that's what admitting privileges are. It's a business agreement between a hospital and a provider that is politically, is subject to politics. And so it leaves abortion access in a state subject to the whim of a hospital's decision, ultimately. And that's what we're seeing in Mississippi, where the last clinic is, you know, hanging on by the thread of the courts as we figure out whether or not it can stay open. And you know, a very clear point by the governor there to say, I want to be an abortion-free state, and this is the way I'm going to do it.
We have really only a few seconds, Erin, but let me just ask, is there any hope, is there any place where things are getting better and not worse?
Well, the doctor who travels to Wichita every week is 32 years old. When you talk to physicians who are in the business of abortion provision, they say that the bright spot is that the younger generation gets it. If they don't step up, there isn't going to be anyone there to provide for these women. So I think that there is a new awareness of the fact that, you know, if not me, then who is it going to be?
Erin Carmone in Los Angeles this morning. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your continued reporting on this matter.
Hi, I'm Max Kaiser. Welcome to the Kaiser Report. Hey, it's all systems fail because of too big to jail. Stacey?
Hey, Max. Well, the big headline this week for me, I put in a tweet, and it says, jailing bankers for market manipulation will not be enough to curb future misbehavior, Mark Carney. Now, this is from a headline from The Telegraph, which read, jailing bankers will not fix bad behavior, says Mark Carney. So he says there's nothing they can do. One tweet response, I think, to set up the story here, is Holborn Wins responded to me and said, hang them then.
Right. Now, when Mark Carney says that jailing bankers is not enough to get them to, you know, change their behavior, I think what he's saying is that the jailing is not enough of a deterrent. Obviously, jailing or minor fines and minor jail terms have not been a deterrent. So in Iran, they hang the banksters. In China, they hang the banksters. And this is proven to be a deterrent. And, you know, in America, there's capital punishment. Okay, the state can kill people for crimes. Why not use it to go after the financial terrorists? Obama says he's against terrorism. Okay, so let's prove it. John Kerry, who says, you know what, Snowden needs to man up and come back to the States. I say to John Kerry, you need to man up and start hanging banksters that are terrorizing your people. Oh, wait a minute. You're a big handbag-waving nincompoop, aren't you, John? Why not use it to go after the financial terrorists? Obama says he's against terrorism. Okay, so let's prove it. John Kerry, who says, you know what, Snowden needs to man up and come back to the States. I say to John Kerry, you need to man up and start hanging banksters that are terrorizing your people. Oh, wait a minute. You're a big handbag-waving nincompoop, aren't you, John Kerry? What a pathetic loser.
But in terms of this case, I think Mark Carney was not saying we should do something more extreme. In fact, he was saying, so we shouldn't do it at all. And many people responded to me on Twitter in this regard. They said, for example, Phil Fee Dirty said, it would be a start. And then Sabine Namba said, is that implying that not jailing them will? So he's saying, let's not even do it at all. But then again, you know, that could apply to almost any criminal. You know, murders still happen, even though we jail them. In America, they execute them with some bizarre medieval techniques, and still people murder. So why, if that's the case, using Mark Carney's argument, we shouldn't jail anybody.
Right. I mean, the British taxpayer is the one ultimately losing. I mean, look, here's a story in today's Metro. The British bill for EU may rise to £500 million. And in the first paragraph, they say, because of the illegal UK-US coup in Ukraine, the British taxpayer is being billed £500 million. So the government says, there's no coup. And then the Brussels is saying, wait a minute, there was a coup. You owe us £500 million. And, of course, they're going to pay for it because Cameron is a toady to the EU. And, you know, Farage can only do so much.
So, and then going back to the story about jailing bankers won't deter it. According to Bill Black, who was a former prosecutor who put away 1,800 bankers in America after the SNL crisis, he said it, in fact, did deter. He spoke to many of these people crying like babies beforehand, saying, please, anything, I'll do anything not to do any jail time. So because, however, there is this theory going around by the central bankers and you know, the attorney generals of the world that we might as well not jail any of these bankers because it won't stop them from doing any crime. Well, this headline, Barclays traders mini puke scammed gold price to cheat client. On the evening of June 27th, 2012, the same day US and UK regulators fined Barclays £290 million for manipulating the London interbank offered rate, or LIBOR, Daniel Plunkett emailed colleagues to say he hoped for a mini puke to 1558 the next afternoon, meaning a drop in the gold price. Plunkett got that by manipulating the fixing, avoiding a $3.9 million payment to a client, according to the FCA. So he did this mini puke a year after he had entered this options contract with a client, whereby it was all or nothing. So either the client won $3.9 million or he lost whatever he had placed on the options. So he basically slammed he told the gold fixing at 3 p.m. on the 28th of June, 2012, that in fact he had hundreds and hundreds of bars of order where he didn't, and then pulled them right after the thing to slam the price.
Right. Well, you see it happening right now. Austria wants the delivery of their physical gold from London. So the mini pukes, as you could call them, the manipulating traders in London, who, of course, are not being deterred by any kind of jail terms, are manipulating the gold market down because London has sold Austria's gold. They've sold it into the open market. It's now in Asia. So now Austria has no chance of getting their gold back. Same thing with Germany. So they're puking paper contracts, as it's called, to slam the price down, giving the Bank of England, Mark Carney, is going to man up and start to buy gold in the open market to make good on the Austrian commitment that they reneged on. So I wonder if Austria has the same opinion about bankers that don't fulfill their promises. So Austria will say, you know, Mark Carney, you owe us our gold. You sold it to Asia. And Mark Carney's going to say, well, we don't punish bankers in England. And Austria will say, okay, then we're declaring war on Britain. How about that for our gold? And then it's off to the races, which is always the case. This is how world wars start. Britain sold Austria's gold. They sold Germany's gold. Europe now needs the gold because of the hyperinflationary money printing by the central bank. So let's go to war. And in that case, gold is going to do very well. But let's do it. Let's get it on. John Kerry, get your Swift boat out. It's time to man up. Get to the front line. Or John Kerry.
Now, remember, the price on June 27th, 2012, closed at $1573.50. So he needed to get it down below $1558.50. So he managed to do that. But remember, one of the arguments that naysayers against gold rigging argue all the time is that you can't possibly rig the market because for every buyer, there needs to be a seller. And every seller, there needs to be a buyer. Well, this case, again, once again, we see that you're able to rig the price to whatever point you want it. He picked a price. He needed exactly the price. That's what he emailed to his colleagues. He needed it below $1558.50. They managed to get it there. How did they get it there if this market is unriggable?
Because they're the buyer and the seller,
exactly.
And they park the errors in the house error account, and then when it gets too big, they get a bailout from the state. Okay, we went over this many times before, whether it's Société Générale, Creville, who's being arrested and sent to prison for doing this exact same thing for his master, the Société Générale. The chairman or president told James Gerville, manipulate the market, and he did. And now they made him the fall guy because Société Générale, technically insolvent. BNP in France, not the racist group here in the UK, technically insolvent. HSBC, Barclays, Lloyds, RBS, technically insolvent. How do they stay afloat? Manipulating the market. How do they finance it? Ultra-low interest rates. Who gives them the ultra-low interest rates? Mark Carney, who doesn't give Austria and Germany back their gold. And I'm beseeching the leaders of Germany, Merkel, invade the UK. Bring back the Blitz. You're not going to get your gold unless you bomb these freaking idiots. That's what I'm saying. Go back into the subway, the underground, and hide from the bombs because Mark Carney sold your gold. Okay, we're going to be in Jersey or somewhere in this godforsaken hellhole.
New Jersey in America, I think, or somewhere better. But so Plunkett, this guy, he booked for Barclays a $1.75 million profit versus the $3.9 million that his client would have earned had his bet, his option,
this is
off.
For Prince Charles, you know, because he was criticizing Putin recently. So let's do a version of the show that Prince Charles would understand had Putin and Russia not entered World War II, and they did. Hach, Milchen, Froch, Nisch, Lichen, Flaschen, Flucken, Flaschischer, Sascha, Frocker, Prince Charles, Flischa, Sascha, Konfischi, von Konka, Schiffa, Sascha. Okay? Because without Russia, Prince Charles would be kowtowing to his German masters. He's an ingracious little punk, along with Mark Carney.
That hardly sounded like German.
I know, it's the worst German accent ever. But I was still thinking about the Blitz. I mean, think of the genius of that.
So the client lost $3.9 million where he would have won it. That means he was stolen from. You might as well have just taken it out of his
pocket.
Yeah,
but there's no deterrent.
That's what I'm saying. So Mark Carney wouldn't arrest him, but he did fine him. He fined the guy $95,600, and the British bank Barclays was fined 26 million pounds. No jail time. Remember David Cameron, what about those little kids who stole $4 bottles of water? If they were old enough to do the crime, they were old enough to do the time. Here, he has to pay a small deterrent, a small fine, a small portion of his ill-gotten gains.
Where's your ration coupons, British people? Mark Carney's screwed it up.
So you mentioned that the low rates are there in order to cover up all these mini pukes, all these naked short sellings, all these violent financial crimes against the financial system around the world, against our savings, against our, you know, futures, our incomes, our jobs. Well, here in the United States, they have a headline, lower rates fail to boost mortgage activity. So total mortgage applications for refinances and home purchases are down 48% on the year. But home sales of both new and existing are up. Why? Because all cash buyers are up. They now account for 33% of all home purchases in the United States, which is in a typical year, on average, is about 10%. So despite the low rates, the bottom 99.9% cannot afford or are not even qualified to be given a loan. Now, in response, the U.S. government, FHFA, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac want to loosen the standards in order to allow the normal Joe Schmo to come into the market to pay, basically to give rewards to the all-cash buyers who have been in there at the bottom.
Right. Well, you can't taper a Ponzi scheme. So they're going to make it easier to flood the market with more Ponzi finance. And they've got now the U.S. is selling bonds through Brussels, through the ECB, to keep the Ponzi scheme going. There is no taper. That's a lie. Janet Yellen is lying. Then you've got the Danny Blanchflower or Paul Krugman failing to tell people that low interest rates cause deflation. They are creating the deflation by keeping the zombie banks alive. I tried to explain this to Danny Blanchflower, but he's an ideologue. He doesn't understand actual day-to-day economics. Same thing with Paul Krugman. They're academics. They know nothing about markets and the way that they work and the fraud and the crime. Black, of course, William Black understands this, but he's been marginalized because they don't want any kind of rule of law anywhere in the United States. And they think it's okay to steal people's gold. Okay, Germany. Austria?
Well, and also remember this big FT piece by Martin Wolf. He was saying that we need to destroy the saver class because they are the rentiers.
There's a place on the underground for Martin Wolf waiting for him with his ration book, you know, waiting for the bombers.
But it's obviously, it's actually enabling the rente, as you see in America,
that
the average person is unable to even benefit from these low rates. There's only one sort of class, one specific small group of people who are able to take advantage of the near 0% rates, and they're doing very well. And again,
the ones who make the bombs.
Yeah, and the ones that are unrehabilitatable, according to Mark Carney, because sending them to jail, they're so hardcore criminals that even jail won't fix them. Threatening jail won't make them stop their evil crime wave.
Well, you know, Britain, don't think of them as bombs. Think of them as love letters from your friends in Germany and Austria. Well, Stacey, we got to go. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Max.
All right, stay tuned for the second half. An interview I grabbed a few days ago with Ronnie Moaz. And speak. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to go to Washington, D.C. and speak with Ronnie Moaz of StandpointResearch.com. Ronnie, welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Thank you for having me, Max.
Okay, Ronnie, you have a 44-page report, essentially blacklist, Morris, Yahoo, Amazon, Apple, on ethical and moral grounds. Why are you blacklisting them? Can you go into this a little bit?
Yes. The first and most extreme example, obviously, is Philip Morris. They are in an industry that is killing 5 million people every year. And Michael Bloomberg has estimated that tobacco will kill 1 billion people in this century. In China alone, there are 1 million deaths alone, and there are 180 million children exposed to secondhand smoke. Now, not only are we losing 5 million people a year to tobacco, but 10% of those, 500,000 deaths, are from secondhand smoke. So you're talking about innocent victims. I don't even want to go into how the children and the grandchildren of these victims have their lives impacted when they lose someone that is close to them.
Okay. Now, Ronnie, you are with Standpoint Research. And this is research that you're making available to money managers, pension funds, and people on Wall Street. So when you do your analysis and when you look at a company like Philip Morris or Amazon or Apple, do you actually ascribe a what's called a morality risk and try to quantify that in terms of what this could mean to the share price if morality were suddenly realized in terms of being discounted by the stock price, if you catch my meaning? In other words, if Apple Computer is... Go ahead.
I understand the question. And the answer is, in a capitalist system where the only thing that seems to matter is what the bottom line is at the end of the quarter, there are going to be very few companies that are clean. Everyone at one level or another is being immoral, unethical, greedy, selfish, unfair. If I was going to start eliminating every stock in the S&P 500 from consideration the minute I saw something that disturbed me, there wouldn't be any stocks remaining to recommend. So what I do is I only single out extreme examples, like you have with Apple, for example, $150 billion in cash. And they're only paying their employees $2 to $3 an hour in Asia. Many of those employees have committed suicide already. I don't want to talk about the S&P 500. I just want to talk about six names in the S&P 500. Apple, Amazon, Walmart, CVS, Starbucks, and McDonald's. Their combined market capitalizations right now is $1 trillion with a T. $1 trillion. All of that money and all of that stock is in the pockets of the multimillionaire and billionaire shareholders. The employees have nothing. It's a disgusting system. There has to be wealth redistribution, and that is the only way that the situation will be resolved.
I wanted to get your thoughts on something. A few years ago, Zach Goldsmith, who's a Minister of Parliament here in the UK, and myself were in the process of creating a hedge fund. And this hedge fund would identify companies like the ones you've identified, for example, Amazon and Apple. And we encourage people to boycott these companies while we simultaneously sold short stock in these companies as a way to monetize that dissent. And then we also suggested that any profits made by this hedge fund would go to the victims of these companies, like the victims of Apple Computer, who are working for slave wages in China. I want to get your thoughts on this as a way to monetize your work and what your thoughts are, Ronnie.
The idea is very clever and very creative. I've never heard anything like that before. But I would have to ask you, what would have happened if you shorted Amazon 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago? Your hedge fund would be out of business right now because the stock went from 100 to 400. Since I blacklisted it, it went from 400 to 300, but I don't know if that had anything to do with my call. I think it just the timing was good and it was a coincidence that there was some bad news coming out around the time that I blacklisted the name. What I would tell you to do, though, is you probably could short those names as a basket so you don't get burned if one of those names goes against you in a short squeeze, for example.
Right. Well, just
does that make sense?
Well, just to be clear, as we iterated this concept in the magazine The Ecologist here in the UK, the boycotts and the short sales were tied to the size of the boycott, and then the shorts themselves were hedged in the options market. So our exposure was never greater than 2 or 3% or the cost of that hedge, and we put the onus on the public.
I see.
Yeah, we put the onus on the public. For in other words, if the public was truly against Amazon and truly against Yahoo and Philip Morris, we put it on them and say, look, you boycott, we'll sell the stock short, and we'll hedge the shorts. And if the price stock goes down, we'll transfer all the money to the victims in India, the victims around the world.
I just want to tell you that sounds like a very good idea. Obviously, it's a new idea being thrown at me, but it's very creative. I think it could work. You just have to be understand that this is something that doesn't happen overnight. Over a period of several years, I think there will be a shift in the consciousness and awareness of people with social media now, and there will be more activism, and what we want to see at the end of the day will happen. It just might not happen as soon as we like.
Okay, on this topic, there are two other groups that are pursuing something similar, Ronnie. There is, of course, the group Anonymous, which announced last year the creation of a hedge fund that would attempt to sell short offending companies. And also there is Weave, who's a troll, a very famous troll who spent some time in prison, who has just announced a new hedge fund concept, and he's seeking funds on StartJoin, the crowdfunding platform. So you're an excellent company, and we applaud your work here, and we wish you to continue to highlight what is the genuine risk of these companies. They are engaged in risks that are externalized. In other words, Apple and Philip Morris and Exxon, this risk is not something that they deal with. All of this risk is externalized and socialized and put into the public domain. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Yes, I think it's only a matter of time before the truth comes out and people start voting with their wallets. These companies at the top that are acting in immoral and unethical ways will not change until they realize that it is more costly not to change. And all they have to do is hear the word boycott, and they will start shaking in their boots, and they will start paying their employees the way they should be paid and looking at paying employees before they pay their shareholders, because that is what has to happen here. It is just inexcusable and indefensible to what level we have stooped in this society where shareholders of a half a dozen companies could be sitting on $1 trillion and the employees have nothing. I don't even want to talk about what's going on with Starbucks coffee bean pickers in Central America. The CEO is sitting on $2 billion. The company's market cap is $50 billion. And the bean pickers are working for $4 a day. It's disgraceful, and it has to stop. And I think with social media, there is a buzz and a little grassroots movement starting right now. And I hope driving a few million people to my website between now and the next presidential election could make all the difference in the world with regards to who gets in 2016.
Now, Ronnie, over there at Standpoint Research, your constituency or the people that are supporting your work, we're talking about essentially Wall Street. We're talking about money managers and brokers who read stock analyst reports all day long, and they're reading your reports. You're not coming to this from the point of, from, let's say, Greenpeace. You're coming to this from the point of view of being a stock analyst. So you are identifying risks that these companies should be aware of. So when these companies read your research, they're seeing potentially some risks to their balance sheet that nobody is talking about. Are they blaming you for pointing out this risk? Is there an idea that, Ronnie, if you just stop talking, nobody will pay any attention to this risk? Are you getting pressure from Wall Street to stop talking?
No, what's happening is I am on the far left. I am on the far left politically. I'm attacking the far right and the upper class. And some of my clients are on the far right and in the upper class. And some of them found it difficult to listen to what I was saying. And I lost a few accounts from the far right, but they've been replaced by accounts that are coming to me unsolicited from the left that admire what I'm doing. I don't think anyone is selling stock based on my blacklist because they don't believe Wall Street will pay much attention to it in the near term. Okay, but people are looking at what I'm saying. They're watching it from a distance. And the minute these stocks start to break down and other people follow my lead, I think you will see people going to the exits because they will not want to listen to the public backlash and the negative public relations that is attached to these names. There are thousands of names to invest in. They may decide to take the path of least resistance and just go with companies that are not in the news in the way that I am putting these names in the news.
Right. Well, I understand the political orientation for sure, but having worked on Wall Street myself, there is a four-letter word that nobody likes to hear. It's called risk. And you are highlighting what could be an enormous risk factor if the public suddenly starts to care about what these corporations are doing. Now, we have about 1 minute left, Ronnie. I wanted to ask you, coming up in July, you're going to be adding some names of companies to your list. Can you speak about this at this time, Ronnie?
Yeah, I would recommend that people go to my new website. It's philanthropyandphilosophy.com, where I am encouraging activism, public, raising awareness to these issues. And I also highlight two dozen charities that are the most highly regarded, highly respected, and efficient organizations in the world. They are doing God's work. They are angels. And we have no excuse not to help these people out. We could eliminate poverty very quickly if people would just start paying a little bit more attention to what is going on around them instead of having an insatiable appetite to consume things that they don't need from companies that do not deserve our revenue.
Right, and let's fund these charities by shorting these very stocks. All right, Ronnie Moas, thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Ronnie Moas of StandpointResearch.com and PhilanthropyandPhilosophy.com. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Put in charge, so there's really no democratic way to, lodge a complaint or try to change anything. It's like it's coming down from the top, and they're looking at selling off all sorts of things, including the water, the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, which looks like they're well on their way to privatizing. And it's clear they want to clear the debt, and the debt, they've got large debt from unpaid water bills, lots of them corporate, some of them institutions like schools, and some of them from individuals. But what they're doing is they're going in and they are ruthlessly shutting off the water services to only to the residences, and they are the poorest of the poor. They're looking at, they're doing something between 1,500 and 3,000 a week now.
Wow.
They're looking to do at least 120,000 cutoff by the end of the summer. They're brutal. I mean, they don't even let you fill up a bathtub or fill up your sinks or pots or anything. When they arrive, they turn it off. And we're talking about families with old people, families with children, unable to flush toilets, unable to turn on their water. And it is a clear violation of the human right to water, which was recognized by the United Nations in 2010.
But is not binding on the United States, unfortunately, around the city of Detroit.
Well, the United States voted for it, you'll be glad to know. Not at the General Assembly, which was the first vote, but the United States was newly on the Human Rights Council, and when the Human Rights Council adopted a similar resolution, the United States agreed.
No, I understand, but these are resolutions, not treaties.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's not like a trade agreement where, you know, if they mean it, they give it teeth, and they only mean the trade agreement. But really, in the international forum, when a new right is recognized, there are obligations on governments, and it is just appalling that in this day and age, poor people who cannot pay their bills are having their water turned off. And it's a lesson for us here in the global north that it's not just poor countries of the global south anymore. You're going to see more and more of this as we privatize our public spaces, as the price of these utilities go up, and as people get poorer and poorer while some people get richer and richer. We're going to see this more Detroit in our future.
It's the third worldization of the United States of America, and it's been going on since the Reagan Revolution. And getting more and more aggressive. So this is Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. I mean, this is just incredible. Detroit is basically being sold off. Let me see if I understand this correctly. They want to privatize. They want to sell the water system to some, presumably even foreign corporation. I think the largest company in the world that owns water systems around the world is a French corporation, isn't it?
There are two of them, Suez and Veolia, and you can be sure that one of them will be involved in this.
Yeah, okay. So they want to sell the water system of Detroit to some other country so that even the profits end up overseas. And in order to do that, to increase its value and thus the price that they'll get from it, so that the Governor Rick Snyder and his cronies in the Michigan legislature can say, oh, look at all the money we got. We can cut taxes on rich people even more for a year or two. In order to increase the price of the water system, they're trying to offload the debt of it so it looks more profitable. And to offload the debt, they have to cut out of the system the people who are in debt who have not been paying their bills. Do I have that right?
You have that right, and it's really important to note that it's a money-making operation. I mean, you know, any private company is going to be happy to have this huge water service. So the debt, yes, is there, but they also make money every year. So it's, you know,
even in the face of people not being able to pay their bills.
Oh, yeah. And as I say, there are a lot of corporate debts, too. It's, you know, they're not going after the golf courses that haven't paid their
why not?
Utilities. Well, you tell me. I mean, this is it. But, look, I want to say this, Tom, because it's really important. We've seen over a million people leave Detroit, the inner city of Detroit. And so money has left, business has left, wealth has left. People who have a certain level of income have left. And what it's done, they didn't have enough people paying enough money for the water services. In other words, they needed to increase the rates, and they increased the rates 120% in 10 years. So
what?
Who left behind were the poorest people, you know, in the community, mostly African Americans, seniors, single mothers, and they cannot afford to pay these incredibly raised rates. The other thing they did was that to cut costs a few years ago, they stopped sending bills, just said, well, you know, come in and pay the bills when you think they're due, sort of thing. Then they put in these smart meters, and the bills went backwards. They counted backwards, sometimes to residents who'd owned the house or were in the house before. So suddenly people were having bills of $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, unable to pay. They are cutting the water off to anybody who owes more than $150. And we are talking about a community where with almost 40% poverty rate and very high unemployment. And these are people who are living on, you know, a fifth of the world's surface water. I mean, they're right on the Great Lakes, right on that basin. How do you square the fact that agribusiness and big bottled water companies and all the golf courses and everybody can get all the water they want, often subsidized, and yet the people are taking it in the neck? This is an absolute violation of the human right to water, and something that must go, I think, should go to the highest level in the United States. I think that President Obama should step in. I think if these were white middle-class people getting their water turned off and their kids taken away, by the way, that's happening too, because there are no working utilities now in these communities, then I think there would be an outcry all over the United States. But because they're poor and African-American and there's this feeling, well, Detroit's finished, you know, let it burn to death, you know, burn down or whatever, I don't think people are paying that kind of attention. And this is the worst. I mean, this is a form of racism. Let's say it out loud. And I think it needs to be dealt with. I visited the community just last week. I've met with people who've had their water cut off. There are protests now. They're growing. You're going to be hearing more about this. This is not going to go away. This issue must go before the American people.
Wow. Wow. What we have just a minute left. What do you see, Maud? What do you see as the best thing that somebody who is listening or watching right now can do?
They can speak to everybody they know. They can get to the media and write letters to the editor so that this information gets out. They can go to our website, Canadians.org, or Food and Water Watch, which is foodandwaterwatch.org, which is our sister group in the United States, and get information and talk to their Congress people, write to the president. We need, especially, and of course, if they live in that state, if they live in Michigan, to write to the governor, because there's no way to, you write to the mayor. The mayor agrees with not with what's happening, with what I'm saying, but he,
right,
you know,
the mayor has no power anymore. It's been given to Kevin
no
Ott, I think his name is the emergency manager.
Kevin Orr. But you can write to Kevin Orr till you're blue in the face. The fact is that the man's got one man.
Well, he's a corporate lawyer.
That's it. I mean, so please do get involved. Don't think this is somebody else's issue, because you know what, Tom? This is coming to other cities if we don't stop it.
There you go. Okay. Maud Barlow, National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians and Chair of Food and Water Watch. Food and Water Watch. What's the website for Food and Water Watch?
Foodandwaterwatch.org.
That's easy enough. Thank you very much, Maud.
Mind.
Think about politics. Folk music might not necessarily be the first thing that comes to mind, but folk has a long and active history when it comes to grassroots organizing and putting the power back in the hands of the people. Two such artists are Harry and Tom Chapin, brothers and prominent humanitarians. And today, Tom's daughters Abigail and Lily Chapin have carried on the family legacy. The duo joined me earlier, along with the grandson of legendary folk singer Pete Seeger, to play some music and promote the upcoming Seeger Fest in New York. Here are the Chapin sisters performing Palm Tree.
Like the wish of the sea. Oh, I'll be Why don't you grow to me? Cross the sand to be. Scrape the sand with your feet. Swinging in the breeze, just out of reach. Oh, I'll be hanging in the leaves of this dusty old palm tree. If you want after me, that's where I'll be, in this dusty palm tree.
You guys are second generation folk singers. Was it always expected that you guys would grow up and be folk singers? How did that start?
I don't think it was expected at all. However, we were kind of pushed onto the stage early in our lives. But it wasn't like you're going to be a folk singer. It was just like, you're here and you can sing, so you might as well join us on stage.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And did you guys ever perform with your as a family unit when you were younger?
We did, yeah. We were always kind of forced to. We would actually, especially in high school, say, like, Dad, we'll come to your show, but as long as you promise not to call us up on stage. And then we would show up, and we'd be, like, hiding in, you know, backstage with our friends, and suddenly we'd hear, and my daughters, Abigail and Lily, are here. And so suddenly we'd be... He would have broken his promise, but, you know, it was kind of a fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on us mm-hmm. situation. It was like fooled us 1,000 times, and still we went.
Lily, you guys also contributed music to Occupy. What was it about that movement that inspired you guys?
The good thing about Occupy is that it stood for so many things that we believed in. We grew up believing that music is... As well as being an amazing tool for community and for art, it's also a platform. So if you're going to stand on a stage, you might as well also stand for something. So the Occupy movement came at a time when there were a lot of issues at stake, and we were there to participate with everybody else. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Abigail, you guys are performing at an amazing folk festival coming up, the Pete Singer Festival. Talk about why this is particularly personal for both of you guys and your family unit.
Our great aunt went to college with Toshi, actually, in the 30s at Bennington. And so our families have known each other for a very long time. We grew up in the Hudson Valley. So we also grew up, our father, Tom Chapin, has been doing benefits for the Hudson River, for Clearwater, for everything. Anything he's asked to do, he'll always do. And often since of the proximity, those shows were with Pete.
Kids, tell me, you are Pete Singer's grandson. When he passed, it was like the world paused for a second and reflected on what his music really brought to just everyone, activism and everything. What made you want to put on this festival?
My grandfather really liked folk concerts, so I'm putting on a folk concert honoring what he did.
And Katama, we found out recently that the FBI is set to release a plethora of documents on your grandfather, Pete Seeger. Not too surprising, I guess, that he was spied on, since all these people were spied on in that COINTELPRO era. Were you guys surprised to find out that he was so heavily surveilled?
I've never been able to send a card to my grandparents. This mail has never gotten to their house that I've mailed, ever. You know, phone calls have the static in them. Often if we say certain words, like if we say, and my mom and I sometimes will joke, it will be like, terrorist, bomb, gun. And it's like, and it went from a really fine conversation to that, to being really staticky. Whether that's a coincidence or not, I have no idea.
He was singing songs about peace and love, and you know, sure, he had political views that did not line up with the state, but that is it's pretty shocking that they are still surveilling his house.
Well, absolutely. And also, later. I mean, my grandpa's views, like, the mainstream views now. Like, you can't, like, walk down the street and be like, you know what? Black and white kids should not go to school together. You know, I should be able to throw all my garbage right there on the ground. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you can't do those things anymore. So all of these things that he stood for and championed are now, you know, completely mainstream things.
Well, I was just going to say, but there are new issues, which hopefully our children will say anyone walking down the street would agree with that issue. But those issues have not yet changed. And your grandfather, I mean, a few years ago in his 90s, would stand out on the street corner in his hometown picketing for no nukes, cleaning up the river, you know, anti-war protests. He did all of those things right up till the end. And so probably, you know, he was always going to be on the forefront of the next thing that seemed dangerous to, you know, the status quo and the powers that be. So, you know, hopefully all of those things will eventually be in the rearview mirror and seem like anyone walking down the street will agree with his views. But he was very progressive for all of his eras.
Yeah. And even though the surveillance state seems kind of normalized now, where we're all awakened to how vast it really is still very shocking and I think completely unacceptable that the surveillance state has spied on activists for so long back in the 70s and 60s. And now today we're about to find out of all the activists that they're spying on.
Right.
Completely absurd.
Our great grandfather was also spied on, actually. We found out when our uncle, who was Harry Chapin, the singer-songwriter, when he went to look at the Library of Congress, they released some FBI files that were on our family as well. So it does go back in so many people's lives, and it should be talked about.
Yeah, and I think what that reveals is that this isn't about fighting terrorism or crime. It's about spying on activism and really creating that chilling effect to prevent people like your grandfather and your family as well from not speaking out and doing their activism. And that's really, really harmful in a free society. Yeah. When is this amazing festival, and where can people go out go to learn more about it?
July 17th to 21st. And the festival is really, it's in New York City, and it's really about think globally, act locally. So the first day is the next generation of folk musicians, and where the two of them are going to be playing.
And it's all free.
Oh, right.
Everything's free.
Yeah. Wow. Everything is free.
So amazing.
It's a community folk event. Yeah. Folk in the great sense of not only folk music, but just an event for the people.
For the community. Yeah. Grassroots, bringing it back to the people, enjoying life, and really getting together. You guys, amazing. Lily Abigail, you guys have a new album out called A Date with the Everly Brothers. Right. How can people find out more about your music?
We have a website, thechapinsisters.com. That's the best way.
Beautiful.
All right.
You guys, amazing to have you
all
on. Thank you so much for performing. Really, really amazing.
Thank
Thanks, guys.
My baby hates me, and it's nobody's fault but mine. He said he'd leave me, but he sure is
some amazing times, everybody. Their father, Harry Chapman, was killed by the COINTELPRO. They didn't quite come out and say that, but that's what happened. And they did something to Pete Seeger, too. It went real fast at the end. They did the same thing to Howard Zinn. It's time for a great big change. And that change is here, and they are the powers that were. We're not going to have what David K. Johnson said. America in the 10th grade just going to say that it was. And let's have a little word from our sister, Dahani Yahoo. It'll be just a little one. I got there. Just there's so much. All this good energy, let's give it a boost, everybody. Very often, my grandfather and the other elders conveyed with a glance what might have taken 2 hours in words to say. Whenever we were taken for a ride or a long walk, as we returned, we were asked to describe the physical characteristics of the terrain and the characteristics of the people that we passed. Then we were asked to describe what we felt and what we sensed. The practice came to be in the dark place of the cabin, with the water drum. In the quiet moments in the dark cabin, I experienced understanding arising like rainbow dreams expressed in the night. The experience of energy of earth, star energy, and universes, past, present, and future, were experienced as conversations moving through my body mind and the others in the room. The sound of the water drum became a chorus of people speaking. Sometimes it said, quote, "This is how it is. Notice this, or notice that." No one said, "Sit down," "Sit straight," "Meditate like this or that." Instead, they created the situation and many images and experiences arose. As I asked, "Who are those other people?" they would say, "Well, they're your relatives." What I would learn later on is that as human beings meditate, a tunnel or a tube opens up, and one can communicate with people all around the world. There is actually a language used among medicine people that sounds like vowel chanting that confirms. Yes, we are connected, and we are making similar observations, and second here, page, similar observations, and we are making prayers. The prayers are not asking for anything. They are energizing the potential to experience that rainbow, shimmering clarity. Preparations for ceremonies, especially of ones of thanks and dedication. We gave thanks by acknowledging all the gifts that are continually showered upon us through the dance of the universe. Giving thanks to the air, to the earth, to the water, to the fire. Rama. Ram. Move that and let's see if Rainbird's here yet. Commander Don, if you can get the Rainbird, if she's not quite there, that would be great. Yeah. Giving thanks to the air, to the earth, to the water, and the fire. We understand. We continuously receive blessings. How wonderful. Then one states why we are doing this ceremony. For example, we can acknowledge the movement and the energy of the moon that nurtures the growth of life in our mothers and our sisters. We can honor the movement of the stars. Let's just do that while I'm reading this. Honor the energy of the moon that nurtures the growth of life in our mothers and our sisters. What Melissa's interview was about tonight, she went really deep into this issue with the feminine and the masculine and the juxtapositioning that was on purpose, you know, programmed into men and women to create this absolutely rapist culture. And by the way, that killing California was all set up. Yes, it was. It was, certainly was. I didn't get to that, but that's another piece. We can honor the movement of the stars, which nurtures the potential of a good harvest in the seeds that we plant or are planting right now. This giving thanks is also acknowledging the circle of relationship. Quote, I inhale you, sweet wind, and dedicate my speech, my thought, and action to bringing forth what is good for my family, my clan, my land, and all my relatives. These are beyond one's own group, and we recognize there is a loop that connects us all. Let's do one more. Circle and breathing attunement. Circle breathing and attunement is done as one senses one's own breath and pulse resonating with the pulse beat of the earth and the sky. To begin the circle breath, inhale and feel the earth arise. Exhale and feel the heavens descend. Consciously let this medicine of breath as light circle around. Perceive the spaces of the body infused with light. And at that point, I pass this long. We circle around, we circle around. Da 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 da. Let's that's again. We circle around the earth. How's that? And the sun and the sky and the stars. And I pass this long-stemmed Excalibur rainbow emerald serpent-feathered rainbow rose talking stick back to my sister along with Quetzalcoatl. Right now, here we come. Rainbird.
I caught it.
Okay, good. Okay.
Oh, I'll take a moment to put my headset back in. Hang on.
Yes, that would be good because you sound like a little mouse.
Okay, that's better.
It certainly is. Thank you, sister. Pass this talking stick.
Thank you. I'll take that beautiful talking stick. Thank you so much, Tara and Rama. Wow. We went full circle tonight, and just such a blessing to do it all, and we're so grateful for all of our lives and all the ways that we go around the moon and around the universe, and we're grateful for this time in our lives, and we're grateful for all of our ancestors being here to witness and midwife and whisper in our ears and carry their heartbeat and take this piece full circle and make this big quantum leap shift. And so such an honor. Lots of gratitude. So thank you, all of you, for showing up here and showing up in your lives. And thank you for your heartbeats. So thank you, all of us. 13 thank yous and honey in the heart. Well, I pass this talking stick back to you. Rama, I'm ready for whatever you have for us. Thank you for your life. I hope.
Here we go.
Okay, is that a new one?
I think so.
You don't know. You didn't check.
No.
That's okay. You can do these things many times. Did you save that one from our sister Maya, too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And thank you, Coleman.
Sparks.
Sparks, yes. For your body of work.
Net music, please. Some nets. Come from the grass to speak with Solomon. Oh, Solomon, you're the champion of the oppressed. You give justice to the little guys. And they don't get any littler than us. We are tiny metaphors for frailty. Can you defend us? Who has mistreated you? Our complaint is with the wind. Well, says Solomon, you have pretty voices, you gnats. But remember, a judge cannot listen to just one side. I must hear both litigants. Of course, agree the gnats. Summon the east wind, calls out Solomon. And the wind arrives almost immediately. What happened to the gnat plaintiffs? Gone. Such is the way of every seeker who comes to complain at the high court. When the presence arrives, where are the seekers? First there's dying, then union like gnats inside the wind.
Hey, good.
You gonna do one? No.
You're supposed to do these little
okay,
sweet
I'll
ones.
Do these. I'll
They're
do
your
these.
Own.
Huh?
I'll read one in a, once in a while.
Okay.
You do the next one.
Inside water, a water wheel turns. A star circulates with the moon. We live in this night ocean, wondering, what are these lights? It's a little quatrain. Inside water, a water wheel turns. A star circulates with the moon. We live in this night ocean, wondering, what are these lights?
One more, come on.
This moment, this love comes to rest in me. Many beings in one being, in one wheat grain, 1,000 sheaf stacks. Inside the needle's eye, a turning night of stars. Inside the needle's eye, a turning night of stars. I am so small, I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside of me? Look at your eyes. They are small, but they see enormous things. I am so small I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside me? Look at your eyes. They're small, but they see enormous things.
This is the first translation that Koma did of Rumi that I memorized of his. Come to the garden in spring. Come to the garden in spring. There's wine and light and sweethearts in the pomegranate blossoms. If you do not come, these do not matter. If you do come, these do not matter. You know, and when I read it, I say, that's a genius Coleman has to understand how incredible the word matter is in English. Matter. Come to the orchard in spring. There's light and wine and sweethearts in the pomegranate blossoms. If you do not come, then these things are not really very important. And if you do come, these things are not very important. What? If you do not come, these do not matter. If you do come, these do not matter.
Okay. You said yes just a second ago. Okay. I think that that's good. We had a really full day. And may we live long and prosper. 13 thank yous, honey, in the heart, and no evil. Yeah. I think David K. Johnson reverberated that refrain earlier today. We indeed have come full circle, and it is still us. We are all one. There is no separate I. It is we. And we're in this peas soup together. And it's quite a pea soup. And tomorrow and Monday at 9:15 Eastern, 6:15 in the Pacific Zone, let's gather together again with Cheryl and do our dance again. And the number is, as it is here, 213-342-3000, and the pin code is 946-7441 pound. So until we meet again, dance in the flowers and plant some roses. And aloha and inshallah and sat nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Ahom Itakuyasin to all seven generations on to now. Mahalo.